Tengo que estar con una.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Interim Committee on Veteran Services and Emergency Preparedness. Today is September 16th, and we have an informational meeting, a lot on the agenda today, a lot to discuss. There will be a lot of updates regarding some past legislation. Looking forward to hearing how that's going. Also, there's the work group that's been getting together on the veterans' preference during interviews. And, of course, a lot of folks say something about that. So let's just be mindful of the time. We have given ourselves, we believe, plenty of time to get this done today. But let's make sure that we respect everybody as we go through the process. I will start with what we call the opportunity to purchase seismic equipment. And if we could please have Representative Nathanson please come forward. So Nancy Nathanson represents House District 13, and she's here today, I believe, with Doug Toomey from University of Oregon. And welcome to your committee, and nice to see you this morning. And you may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Nancy Nathanson, House District 13. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. I attended a briefing at the University of Oregon a few months ago. There were several faculty present talking to Congressman DeFazio and to me about the work that not only the University of Oregon but others are doing in the area of monitoring seismic activity and how that might relate to earthquake warning. The information that they presented that day was so impressive that I became convinced that I thought it was important for the legislature to hear about the work that the university and others around the state and, in fact, the whole West Coast are doing in this area. So with me today is Professor Douglas Toomey, Professor of Geophysics at the University of Oregon, and I won't take any more of your time because this is where the real smarts are.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Matthews and committee members. I'm Douglas Toomey, a professor of geophysics at the University of Oregon, and I want to thank the chair and all members of the committee for the opportunity to submit testimony about improving monitoring of earthquake and volcanic hazards in Oregon. My colleagues and I lead research focused on seismic and volcanic activity in the Pacific Northwest, and today I will emphasize a time-sensitive opportunity for the state of Oregon to purchase National Science Foundation-owned seismometers that are currently installed in Oregon but are slated soon to move to Alaska if we don't act. Purchasing these high-quality sites will greatly enhance monitoring of earthquake and volcanic hazards in Oregon. In my testimony, I'll outline the hazards of the Cascadia subduction zone, explain how a timely investment will benefit the Pacific Northwest and the state of Oregon in particular, and describe a future when an earthquake early warning system monitors the Cascadia subduction zone in real time. A magnitude 9 earthquake and tsunami comparable to those that occurred in Alaska in 1964, Sumatra in 2004, Chile in 2010, and Japan in 2011 has and will again hit the Pacific Northwest. The source of this devastating earthquake will be the Cascadia subduction zone, which lies beneath the coastal areas of Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. It's been more than 300 years since the last great earthquake and tsunami, and we are in the window of recurrence. The Pacific Northwest is unprepared for a catastrophe of this scale. FEMA estimates that the direct financial losses would be $60 billion, while the Insurance Bureau of Canada expects losses of approximately $75 billion in Canada. Because the Cascadia fault zone lies offshore, we do not understand it as well as onshore faults. The NSF sensors that the state has the opportunity to buy represent an important part of a larger effort to help prepare Oregon for the next big one. The University of Washington and the University of Oregon operate the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network that locates more than 1,400 earthquakes per year greater than magnitude 1 in Washington and Oregon and provides an assessment of earthquake and volcanic risk. The University of Oregon is responsible for maintaining and monitoring sensors and stations located in Oregon. In addition, the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network records seismic data that is fundamental to the research programs of many Pacific Northwest researchers. It serves science and public safety at the same time. Unfortunately, the state of Oregon has many fewer sensors than necessary, particularly in southwestern Oregon, and falls short of its neighbors in funding this vital area of public safety and research. The states of Washington and California, for example, provide annual support of $600,000 and $1.2 million to the University of Washington and UC Berkeley, Caltech, respectively. To drive home just how unprepared we are, consider the map shown on the display to your right. This map shows seismic stations operated by the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. Observe the near absence of earthquake monitoring sites within the large red circle encompassing southwestern Oregon. If we presume that the next massive earthquake in the Cascadia subduction zone begins in Northern California and unzips to the north, then it's obvious that our current capacity to detect earthquakes in this crucial region is woefully inadequate for protecting society. What I would like to highlight today is a unique opportunity to purchase part of an NSF array of seismometers currently installed in Oregon. The consensus of Pacific Northwest scientists who study earthquake hazards is that acquiring these seismometers is of the highest priority. Moreover, it is cost-effective to purchase these installed and operating instruments before they are demobilized and moved to another region next summer. In 2015, this NSF array will move to a new site. However, the onshore seismometers and vaults can be purchased. There are 27 high-quality vaults, which include strong and weak motion seismometers and telemetry already installed in Oregon and Washington. 15 of these sites are in Oregon and provide enhanced coverage of the Cascadia subduction zone and the volcanic arc. The total cost to purchase all 15 sites is $670,000, and this is effectively 50% off the original cost to purchase and install these sites. There are several advantages to purchasing the NSF array sites that are currently located in Oregon. It will greatly enhance capabilities of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network in poorly covered regions of Oregon. That's effectively the central and southern parts of our state. It will contribute infrastructure to earthquake early warning in Oregon, and it will amplify the research capabilities and future funding opportunities for Pacific Northwest scientists. In support of my testimony, I have submitted a scientific consensus statement that is signed by prominent researchers from throughout the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. I would like to close by describing a future when an earthquake early warning system provides citizens with real-time warning to take emergency action. An earthquake early warning system is well suited for the impending magnitude 9 earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. This is because the most powerful earthquakes in our region occur along a fault that lies primarily offshore as opposed to directly beneath major metropolitan areas. Given the immense length of this fault, if it were to begin rupturing in the south, Portland could receive a warning as much as 3 minutes and Seattle as much as 5 minutes prior to severe shaking. Even in Eugene, Oregon, where I live, our schools, businesses, and hospitals could be warned by as much as 2 minutes before the shaking starts. 2 minutes is a long time. I asked the principal of a local elementary school, which was built in 1926, how long it would take to evacuate all 350 students. The answer, a minute and a half. Only a West Coast earthquake early warning system can provide advanced warnings that will save lives, protect businesses, and facilitate a more rapid recovery for local communities, the state and federal governments, and the economy as a whole. An investment by the state of Oregon that purchases the NSF seismometers currently installed in Oregon will not only improve current monitoring of earthquake and volcanic hazards, it will also contribute infrastructure that supports earthquake early warning, and will help position Oregon universities for future federal investments in that program. I thank the chair and all members of the committee for their leadership in holding this hearing.
Thank you. So I guess, you know, we can establish a platform for the need and have the discussion today, but you mentioned $670,000, that's 50% off the rate that it normally would be.
Yep.
Potentially can give 2 minutes of warning in some places that would receive no warning now. Pretty substantial impact, and, you know, I come from a world where seconds matter. Right. I guess my question for you, though, is what is the process at this point? How do we, you know, we could be very supportive of the purchase, but how do we go about that? What's the next step?
Well, the seismometers are owned by the National Science Foundation that are run by IRIS. And when you provide the money, when the state provides the money, we can purchase those directly from the National Science Foundation. Several states throughout the Western United States and Central U.S. have already purchased seismometers from NSF, so there is a procedure for doing that.
Wonderful. And let's go with Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Question would be, is there a finite capacity or amount of those that are available at that price, and or when does that deal kind of expire? So just the kind of coupon or me, but at some point that price changes or that availability goes. So what's our timeline to...
Okay. So the timeline, there's a letter that's submitted to the committee that you have from IRIS, which is an incorporated research institution in seismology. And those seismometers have to be removed in fiscal year 2015. And what that means is probably early in the spring of 2015, they're going to start removing them because the National Science Foundation and IRIS does not have money to operate them beyond next summer. So if we don't purchase them, then early in spring and summer of 2015, those sites are going to be demobilized and moved.
Sure, follow up.
So is this going, just because of the timeline and when we come back in 2015, and is this going to be an e-board request? Or where does that money come from if we needed to get you money since we're not in session?
I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I have had some initial conversations with the Legislative Fiscal Office and with a co-chair about the process for getting in queue to make a request for this money. I've also asked for some information through the university to make a connection with basically our federal contacts to find out what would be required if money had not been allocated yet, what kind of letter of intent or letter of interest might be sufficient to at least delay the removal of the equipment while the legislature is deliberating this.
Great. Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just sitting here strategizing how to do this, short of taking out our checkbooks. Really want to do this, and I think we really should. So with the money that the President has pledged, the $1 billion from HUD, would that qualify if Oregon, we hope Oregon will be applying for that, would that qualify for this kind of use? Because I thought that was a sort of a safety thing, overall safety issue from resilience planning.
It's certainly something to lead to, but I don't believe that the answer is sitting at the dais at this point.
Okay.
And we can look into that a little deeper. Any further questions, Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. One is that the, whatever you call it, put the equipment in the name of the organization, and now they want to pull it out. Why did they put it in the first place if their intention was to pull it out?
Oh, thanks for the question.
Or did they just run out of money?
Yeah, Chair and Representative Esquivel. It was part of a temporary experiment called the Cascadia Initiative. So the National Science Foundation actually run the Cascadia Initiative, which is a $30 million experiment funded by the National Science Foundation. It's an onshore, offshore experiment where there were seismometers on the seafloor and seismometers on land. The scientific community and the National Science Foundation recognized the potential hazards in the Pacific Northwest, and they did. And we are currently conducting a four-year experiment that ends in 2015. The National Science Foundation, through stimulus money, provided the funds to purchase these seismometers, and that facility is going to move to another site in 2015, most likely Alaska.
Okay. Then my other question, Mr. Chair. We say that this happens every 300 years, the Cascadia effect, and by the way, we need to just do this. I mean, this is nothing really to think about, because I mean, if you save one child or you save one human life, it's worth $670,000 to me or whatever it is. But how do we know this happens every 300 years? Because we weren't around We were around in the 1700s, but we weren't here in the 1400s.
Right.
Allegedly.
So just...
I'm curious how you calculate this.
Yeah. Like, see a birth certificate.
For the record, maybe our chair was around in the 1400s, but I wasn't.
I will talk to Representative Jensen and just kidding.
I'm not sure.
Good friend.
I'm not sure I can comment on relative ages of people on the committee, but... First of all, just to clarify, every 300 years, it's not a periodic event, right? It's not clockwork every 300 years, and that's part of the problem with earthquakes globally, is that you can come into a window of reoccurrence, and it may happen at 200 years or 500 years. You know, it doesn't always have to be every 300. How we know that there's been a number of those is that these large earthquakes generate what are called turbidites. So when you go out to the coast, the water's shallow, and then it deepens down to the abyssal area. So there's a sand pile there that is continually being built up by beach sand, and it's unstable. When it shakes in a magnitude 9 earthquake, that landslide under sea happens, and it deposits on the seafloor a record of the landslide. So there are two ways that we know this, and I'm going to make my answer a little bit long because it's fascinating. The first is that if you've ever gone up and down the Oregon coast, you know when the settlers first came here and they logged the area and shipped those logs to Seattle and San Francisco, they took the most valuable wood they can find. But in the estuaries, you'll find stands of cedar that are dead, and so some geologists wondered, why do we see these stands of cedar that haven't been logged? And what happened was in the last earthquake, in between earthquakes, the land's coming up, and so the trees have their roots in fresh water. And when the earthquake occurs, it goes downwards, and the coastal area can drop by about 10 meters, and so these cedar trees dip their roots into brackish water, and they all died. So geologists cored all those and found out they all died simultaneously 300 years ago. So then they thought, okay, let's go offshore and look for a record of this, and they found turbidites. Then they drop cores through the sediment, and they start counting turbidites. Then you can look for things like mazama ash. That's what, 12,000 years ago is mazama, I forget. You can date various things, and then you can count the turbidites and put a time on them. And there's roughly 19 to 20 of those turbidites off coast that Chris Goldfinger at Oregon State University has dated, and others.
Amazing.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to ask any more questions.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel. And thanks for your explanation. I appreciate it. It is fascinating.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. I had to say, Doctor, you looked at Representative Nathanson to get affirmation of the dates. So we know she's smart. We had no idea she was
Well, I think you find a consensus that we're supportive of the concept and the idea moving forward. I won't be here next session to, unfortunately, push that along, but I'm sure that you will find a lot of advocates here before you, and, of course, Representative Nathanson and the great work she's been doing. Resilience planning is part of what we've also been experiencing at this level and trying to find a way to get that resilience plan from paper to actually a solid foundation for the plan. And yet it's got to be incremental in growth. But we don't have time on this one. We have got to move quickly. So appreciate your work, and thank you for bringing it forward. And again, Ms. Ross, who's not here today, has done a phenomenal job of setting us up today. And thanks for your time today. I appreciate you coming in. Thank you
as well for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I see we have our Secretary of State. Are you coming forward, or will it be your team?
I'm going to let my very capable team handle it this morning.
Wonderful. So if they would like to take stage, Gary Blackmer, and is it Sharon Blassie? Blasey?
Oh.
Yes. Will you be performing solo today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us. What I'd like to do is an introduction and let the two people who have all the answers take my place.
Absolutely, not a problem. And thank you for being here this morning. And,
yep. And we'd also like to have Cameron Smith up when I sit down. So, because from our standpoint, when we do an audit, we're trying to look for ways that agencies can improve. And one thing that we never want to do is interfere interfere with the improvements. Let's see, do I need to introduce myself?
For the record, yeah, you always recognize that, right? A little.
For the record, my name is Gary Blackmore. I am the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. We don't want to interfere with agencies that are making efforts to improve. And so what you see here is actually not an audit report. It's a general review of the organization, because we went in with an initial look at it and decided that there were a lot of changes going on that looked like they were addressing issues that we would be looking at as auditors. So we backed out of it, but we felt it was important at least to record what we saw and also add some further considerations. So it's not that these are recommendations that should replace anything they're doing now, but it's more like, and in addition, you might think about. So that's essentially what this report is. And so with that, I'd like to sit down and invite Cameron up.
Thank you, sir. Cameron Smith, if you'd like to come forward, you may take a seat. Good to see you, sir.
Good morning. Chair Matthews, members of the committee, my name is Elliot Schubert. I'm a performance auditor with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about our recently released review of the performance of ODVA. We initially started, as Gary mentioned, a multi-agency audit that was focused on the coordination of veteran services in Oregon. As part of that work, we spoke to a range of different stakeholders and community partners, and we heard a lot of real positive feedback and praise for the work that ODVA does. That's not always the case when we do performance audits, but it was in this case. And we also reviewed the recent changes underway and the efforts underway at ODVA. So we decided at this time not to do a full audit, but are instead issuing this report, which gives additional considerations for the department to consider as they're implementing and refining their strategic plan. Generally, those considerations fit into a couple of big categories. One, there's a set of considerations that strengthen the oversight of County Veteran Service Officers, or the CVSO program, ways to better identify veterans and conduct outreach, some ways to continue to develop key partnerships with other agencies and service providers, and then finally, ways to improve and expand the training that's offered by the department. As you're aware, ODVA plays a key role in coordinating veteran services in Oregon. A large part of this work is their oversight over the County Veteran Service Officers, or the CVSO program. We recognize the department is focusing on strengthening its relationship with CVSOs. Now, CVSOs are, all CVSOs are county employees, and so we recognize that there's a challenge with oversight of those employees. Still, our report points out a few ways the department could consider to strengthen that oversight. They include developing clear performance standards for CVSOs. The department may also consider communicating those standards to those whom the CVSOs report, which it's worth noting varies considerably from county to county. CVSOs may sit in a position within a county health department, or they may report directly to the elected leadership for that county. So it varies quite a bit throughout the state. CVSOs, the department may also wish to develop new or refine the existing reporting requirements that they require of CVSOs. Federal VA data shows that relatively low percentages of Oregon veterans are accessing their federal VA benefits, as is the case in other states. The identification of veterans is sort of a key or a starting place to allow the state an opportunity to inform those veterans about their benefits. So the report notes a couple of areas that could be strengthened to help expand the identification and outreach to veterans. These typically involved other state agencies. So we looked at some applications for state programs. And so what I'm talking about here is if a member of the public decides they want to enlist in a program that the state offers, like a SNAP or TANF, that the questions on those applications vary with respect to what they ask about military status. So, you know, they might ask what VA income the person is receiving, or if a member of their household is a veteran. This is particularly an issue because we heard that many people who would likely qualify for veterans benefits may not consider themselves actually a veteran. So, for instance, anyone who served in active duty but may not have served in combat may not consider themselves a veteran. So the terminology of those questions is really important. So the ODVA may wish to consider partnering with state agencies to ensure that widely used state applications reflect the most important questions or the most appropriate questions to clearly identify people who are appropriately veterans. some agencies, per legislation, are asking members of the public about their military service and sharing the veteran referral information with ODVA. In some cases, in one case, it is unclear whether ODVA can share this information directly with CVSOs. So ODVA might again consider partnering with state agencies to ensure that the information sharing and the data sharing between those with those agencies is streamlined and effective. Related to the information sharing, we know that ODVA is working on their capacity to collect and analyze data. That's something that they're actively working on in their strategic framework. The department has identified those challenges and is working on that. Another tool for identifying veterans is the Public Assistance Reporting Information System, or the PARIS program. PARIS program is a sort of joint federal and state program that provides states with matched data that shows those who are receiving public assistance in that state on various programs like Medicaid and who are also veterans. So it's people receiving public assistance who are also veterans. It's that matched data that's provided to the state. Typically, it's given to the state agency that administers Medicaid and Medicare. Some states have robust PARIS programs, which seem to have been very successful in helping to ensure that veterans are getting their maximum federal benefits for which they are entitled. In some cases, this means that those veterans are able to move off of partially state-funded programs as they access a wider array of federally funded VA benefits and programs. And then those state funds are then available to help assist others in those state programs. Here in Oregon, DHS is starting a pilot project in some of its programs to use that PARIS data. A report says that ODVA could consider developing a partnership with DHS and OHA to ensure that the PARIS data management will help veterans access and maximize their federal benefits. The department has identified the use of partnerships as a key strategy in its strategic framework, which aligns with several of the considerations we outlined in our report. The department may wish to strengthen some existing partnerships or may see the need to develop new ones. In the area of higher education, ODVA may consider partnering with colleges and universities in our state to assist in the outreach and recruitment of new veteran students and also helping to maximize their academic success. Continuing to develop or strengthening ODVA partnerships may help in the marketing of veteran employment programs and might also help ensure that there's widespread awareness of support services for homeless veterans or those at risk of becoming homeless. Finally, training was another area of consideration that we outlined in our report. In addition to helping veterans file claims and access federal benefits, ODVA told us that CVSOs play an important role in their community by helping veterans access other services. Since this work is not currently included in ODVA's CVSO training and certification process, the department may wish to consider including such referral work, given its importance to veterans in our state. We heard differing views from community partners and CVSOs about how veterans who are receiving state assistance through programs like Medicaid may be affected should they pursue federal VA benefits as well. ODVA may want to consider clarifying how state and federal VA benefits affect one another and be sure to include this information in training to CVSOs. Caseworkers and other community partners may benefit from such training as well. In closing, ODVA is refining and implementing its strategic framework. We really appreciated at this time an opportunity to provide some additional insight that the department could consider, which may help further assist veterans in Oregon. With that, I thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about our review.
Thank you for that. Do we want to hear from anybody else on the panel before we get to questions, or is that kind of the report for now and everybody's available for questions? Great. And today really was about bringing forward to showcase the audit and also the talent and the work and the effort of the ODVA. I think veterans need to hear this, that things are going on and things are checks and balances along the way. And that's why we wanted to have this informational hearing today, to try to get this out there so we can talk about ways that we can improve. What are we doing well and what are the areas where we can do a little bit better? But ultimately, our state suffers from the same as a lot of states, and that is, how do you get a veteran to believe they're veterans, and how do you get them to go access the benefits they deserve? And so we're trying to get there. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Escobar.
I want to commend the department, because every time I have a problem with the feds, I end up going to Cameron's department, and they sort out the information, get the person on the right track, and get them their benefits. And I think that's a great way to, for a clearinghouse for our Oregon veterans, to have an opportunity to speak with someone that's in Oregon instead of someone that's on a 1-800-VET, whatever it is, phone line. And we have a personal approach here in the state of Oregon. I think that's something that is very remarkable that we have within this department, and Cameron has a lot to do with it.
Absolutely. Any questions from the committee? I will say, too, you know, when you mentioned the CVSOs and you talk about performance standards, you know, having talked with a lot of recruiters in the area, certain demographics just are easier to serve than others. I mean, throughout our state, there are kind of regions where it may be easier to pull some veterans in to get them access versus others. And I'm sure that that's part of your consideration when you look forward to recommending the recommendations. Is that right?
Chair Matthews, that's correct. I mean, Oregon obviously is a very diverse state. We have counties differ considerably in how they're arranged and the demographic makeup. The veterans population, it's worth noting, cuts across every segment in society, basically. So it's a diverse population in and of itself. And it's true, as I pointed out, that the position of the CVSOs in their community, physically and administratively, varies quite a bit. So the accessibility of CVSOs varies. So it's a nuanced picture.
And the money we could potentially save bringing veterans off of the state assistance into the federally funded programs would be also, I think, pretty substantial if we can just get that to happen.
Chair Matthews, we didn't look specifically at the Paris program in great depth, but we know that in the state of Washington, they're saving several million dollars every year through active use of that data system. And it's working through a partnership between the health administration in that state and then the state's Department of Veterans Affairs. And they've been actively managed, I think, probably on the order of $5 to $7 million a year that they're saving by implementing and having targeted referral and sort of careful case management using that Paris data.
Sure. To our director, Cameron Smith, did you have anything you wanted to add to wrap this up? You're going to be on next for
Good morning, Chair Matthews, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome back to Salem, and good to have you all back in the building. I'll say a few comments, and then I might let these folks escape from the hot seats. Most of our response to the review and the audit is as part of our strategic framework. It's aligned with it, and that's what we'll roll into here briefly. But do want to call out Secretary of State Kate Brown's leadership and her strong support for veterans. She was a key effort and key supporter of the World War II memorial effort here on the corner in Wilson Park, 70 years after D-Day that we finally got that completed, but has also attended countless mobilizations and demobilizations on behalf of the governor and our legislative leadership and our statewide electeds, honoring the Guard both as they head overseas and come home. And most of the time when my fellow agency directors see Gary and his team of auditors coming down the hallway, they quickly do a 180 and go in the other direction. But I want to call out, we are always looking for opportunities as agencies to make ourselves better. There are no shortage of challenges across any of the agencies, our own included, and you know, the considerations are, if anything, don't go deep enough into the big issues that we face. And we are always hungry for that outside, external perspective on our work. And I believe this, and sometimes we reach out for consultants. We have this opportunity within our own audit team, both on the financial audits and the performance audits. It's an opportunity for us to grow and move forward down the line. So we're looking forward to implementing these and incorporating them as part of our strategic framework.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Secretary of State Kate Brown. Thanks for your leadership, and Gary Blackmer on your crew for another job well done. Thank you for your, you know, just for looking into the veterans issues and seeing where we can be a little more efficient, what we're doing well, what we can do better. And that's what it's all about as we continue to move veterans forward as a state.
And Chair Matthews, members of the committee, I felt like Elliot was on our team, on our staff for a while. He was literally at every event, every stakeholder group. They did leave no stone unturned. It's a small military veterans community, but he literally became a part of it for the last 6 months. And Sharon was quiet, but a veteran herself and also a great auditor, so she was great for the team.
Thank you, and we give everybody the opportunity, Sharon. So you're a veteran. Which branch?
Chair Matthews, I was a 14-year Navy veteran. So my last duty station was Bremerton, Washington. I was assigned to the USS Sacramento, a fast combat support ship.
Wonderful.
We're still trying to sign her up for the Guard so we can get her a full retirement.
Yeah, there you go. Well, thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Very much appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Elliot. Thank you. Have a great day. And with that, Director Smith, you will continue on and give us a little update on where we're at with the ODVA.
So, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, I need to take a page out of Secretary of State Kate Brown's book and have my team present on these things going forward, because I feel like I'm going to be exhausted after this. But a great opportunity for us. Just as we had that review with Secretary of State, it was very much a shared review with our own new team at the department. Seven out of our nine key managers, either new to their seat or new to the agency, probably about 20-30% turnover of our long-tenured staff over the last year and a half. As we have been digging in, we've been able to present this strategic framework that we think brings focus to what is a very diverse effort for our veterans and their families. Maybe can we dim the lights a little bit? So we've been framing it as a new cadence forward, and that really speaks to the diverse partnerships that are essential. It's not just ODVA's work, not just the federal VA or our county veteran service officers, but the broader community support is critical for our veterans and their families. We cannot overemphasize the timeliness and importance of this shared review. Over 70 years, 2015 will be our 70th anniversary as a state agency, stood up after World War II, but never have we before been serving so many veterans and as diverse a group of veterans across four generations, across five major wars from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, Iraq and Afghanistan, plus all those who served on peacekeeping missions and humanitarian missions around the world in between. One out of 10 Oregonians is a veteran. Over 320,000 veterans across the state. Many of them live up and down the valley in our major cities in the metro areas, but you get to the more rural communities and you get a quarter to a third of the population is veterans, so lower raw numbers, but a significant population of rural Oregon. And again, we are every age and every era. We have been losing our World War II veterans. Just a year ago, that World War II number would have been double. So we are losing them quickly, and Korea not far behind. Vietnam veterans still the largest portion of our veterans population. Peacetime is at a quarter. Gulf War, and then while we hear a lot about Iraq and Afghanistan and the current generations of veterans, only 6.6% of that population overall for the 320,000 veterans. And again, a very diverse group, men and women, urban, rural, every ethnicity and creed under the sun. About 9% are women veterans for our population, about 8% are minorities, and then 1% Native American that we like to call out have served at a higher rate per capita from our Native American tribal members than any other ethnic group. But what we heard out of the Secretary of State audit and what we've testified repeatedly, only about 3 in 10 Oregon veterans access those robust federal benefits. And this is largely pulled off of the healthcare data for federal VA and the key disability compensation. This is not something to run from. We are a top 10 state for veteran services. Over the last 2 years, fiscal year 13 and 14, 16,000 new claims for veterans, and then 71,000 total claims for secondary or tertiary conditions as we move forward in the claims process. And beyond veterans and their families thriving in Oregon, this is a huge economic force multiplier for our communities. So this calls out total VA dollars spent in Oregon, both for their fiscal year 2013, or I guess calendar year 2013 and then calendar year 2012. So $2.2 billion across from all the disability compensation, pension, the claims, the education, GI Bill benefits, and healthcare is the other largest portion. $2.2 billion, almost incomprehensible. Half of that is coal cold hard cash in terms of compensation and pension payments into the bank accounts and wallets of veterans and their families. And that increased by about $300 or $200 million from 2012 numbers. And that really speaks to the strength of our veteran services system and having that accredited and certified representative navigating a challenging system. $959 million in healthcare benefits through the federal VA, both at the major medical centers and the clinics that they've pushed out to into the community care. If we looked back, this is just the 13 and 12 numbers. If we looked back a decade, these numbers would all be in half. So literally, we have doubled the amount of federal VA impacts, and that speaks to a lot of congressional support and leadership by bipartisan presidents at the executive level. But it's significant, so about $450 million flowing in 2003, and now double that to $1.1 billion in cold hard cash. Again, we try to break it down in more digestible numbers. So that $1.1 billion in cold hard cash becomes $92 million flowing into Oregon's economy every month. For a larger county on the annual basis, it would be over $100 million. But even to our more rural communities like Coos, over $30 million a year flowing into the rural counties. With high veterans populations. And the impact per veteran, per capita, $14,271 is the average disability compensation and pension benefit. If you think kind of 10% disabled all the way up to 100% disabled, anywhere from $100 a month up to over $36,000 a year. So you can see there's a significant opportunity to drive that number further in terms of how number of veterans tapping those benefits and to be able to reduce the general fund expense on a lot of state safety net services. And the top 10 metric that we often use is hinging off of this key performance measure of the per capita disability comp and pen benefit payments. We have states reaching out to us looking at how they can raise their numbers, which is on average about $2,000 more in Oregon per veteran. So we have dug in with our team over the last year, and it's for the size of our veterans population, for the diversity, and then the diversity of the issues we face across healthcare, mental health, education, employment, housing, all the issues that we are here to testify on in front of you repeatedly, that breadth demands focus to the effort that we bring. So with our new team, the basics, let me see if I can get rid of this. Back to basics, not that we didn't have a vision, mission, and core values beforehand as a team and as an agency, but just refining that. So our vision, where we want to go, that veterans and their families thrive in Oregon. Our mission, more focused, our target, ODVA serves and honors veterans through our leadership, our advocacy, and strong partnerships. To me, that one speaks, it's not just our lane. We need to make sure we're doing our work well, but it's also where we bring our leadership and advocacy to those partnerships. And then our core values of respect, integrity, stewardship, and excellence, which conveniently spell RISE, so we will rise to the challenge as we work to achieve our mission and achieve the implement our mission and achieve our vision. And I want to talk briefly today about, we've built this as a five-year plan, 2014 through 2019, and wanted to talk about our main key goals, strategic goals, objectives, and then the strategies underneath them. We've been giving this brief to congressional partners, veteran service organizations, fellow agencies. We'll give a brief to the governor's staff next week. These are all candidly still very high-level strategies, and as we continue to work as a team, we blow these up both into policy, you know, how do we use existing resources, how do we frame legislative concepts and budget proposals going forward. But the key goals, strategic goals for us are target veteran services, mobilizing partnerships, driving veteran engagement, and then invigorating our core operations. And the way we have framed this, when we look at kind of previous strategic plans from ODVA, often they were more narrowly targeted on our core programs, the home loan program, the veterans home in the Dalles, and the one we're standing up in Lebanon, our claims and our conservatorship, and then our claims and counseling work in partnership with the counties. And we've kind of inverted that. Those, we need to make sure those programs are working well and to the best of their ability. But we know veterans have broader issues than that. How do we bring the leverage to bear both across that veteran services with that big inverted pyramid of the federal VA with the $160 billion total budget? How do we mobilize those partnerships
And then sometimes it's just simply the awareness of the issue. Are we the right resource at the right time in front of the veteran? So targeting veteran services is our greatest opportunity. It's what allows us to tap into the federal VA and that inverted pyramid and significant budget. And we have the objective to serve more veterans and serve them better. So we want to raise that number in terms of 3 in 10 veterans tapping their benefits to 4 in 10, to 5 in 10 over the next 5 years. When we compare ourselves to other states, Oklahoma, roughly the same number of veterans as our community, a little bit more, more of a state-controlled veteran service officer network, so a little more centralized in terms of that control, but they bring in about $400 million extra in disability compensation and pension, which kind of gives us a target beyond what we could potentially save on state safety net services. We believe we could, you know, other states are drawing down more. As good as we are, there's a huge opportunity for us to drive that further. We need a 21st century veteran services system that speaks to the electronic claims process. We now have the counties submitting electronic claims to ODVA. We're still in a paper system that we print out at our Portland claims and hand that off to the Fed VA. But eventually the feds will turn on that electronic claims process and make a seamless system so that we can all track it and get quicker turnaround on these claims and continue to reduce the backlog. And we've also been focusing what are the core responsibilities and roles that are different from a statewide veteran service perspective and that local boots on the ground county veteran service officer. The county VSO, they have a dual-pronged mission, both submitting those power of attorneys and drawing down those federal resources, but then also being that belly button in the community, linking to nonprofits, community colleges, faith-based employers, the broad network. When we look at our own level, from statewide veteran services, what's our role and responsibility in this service, in this veteran service system? It truly is on the claims review or the training, first and foremost, of the county VSOs. Sometimes in the rural counties, it's one veteran service officer. When that turnover happens, that's a significant amount of knowledge leaving the county and support for their veterans. It's our folks at the statewide level that helps school up those next folks coming on board to be a VSO at the county level. We're going to be positioning ourselves more in a claims review process, making sure that we are teeing up the best product possible so that we get better decisions out of the federal VA on rating decisions, that we don't kick it into an appeals process that then takes multiple years on the back end to unwind. So a huge opportunity in that target veteran services and where we see the most leverage and is our number one strategic goal moving forward. But even if we maximize that veteran services system from the county to the state to the feds, we know we wouldn't approach any other work like that at a local, state, and federal level in terms of education or mental health. You want that strong community base on up to a smaller federal government role in it. So when we look at mobilizing partnerships is to build that community network much more broadly beyond the strictly folks who are in the veteran services business. It's the nonprofits, it's the housing authorities, it's the cities and counties, it's the education institutions, our public sector and private partners as well. And we want to leverage all resources available to veterans. This will also help us maximize those upfront preventative resources, reduce the back end expensive safety net systems. And where we are going to be laser focused, given how many different issue areas we could approach, we have keyed in on health and wellness and education and economic opportunity for our veterans as the two key areas. Even those are two large buckets in and of itself, but those will be our major areas driving the partnerships forward. And we use economic opportunity not just to mean employment, but we're trying to bring a little bit more of a entrepreneurial and small business support. There's something naturally, whether a military service member retires with 20 years and has a retirement income or has a disability compensation, that kind of safety net on a little bit of income combined with their natural values, their leadership, there's a business ethos that we could tap into our veterans. So not just looking at what we can do on employment, but also how we can support small business owners that are veterans. We also are looking at how do we support those statewide networks, the vet nets that we see. I was down in Southern Oregon and at Punky's Diner, there's just an informal veterans group that just coalesces. There's kind of these informal networks from World War II to today, and then the more formalized, whether out of the Legion or the VFW, Southern Oregon Veterans Roundtable, that kind of out of the Table Rock campus. So a lot of how do we support those and model those best practices across those networks and begin to create that web across a community. Driving veteran engagement, the third goal, amplifying awareness of resources and building the Oregon Veterans brand. This is really about making sure that we're doing everything from our print publications to the online marketing to the peer-to-peer supports. That's important, whether we're dealing with women veterans or Vietnam veterans or hard-to-reach veterans. Looking at everything that we can do to make sure there are more resources available for veterans, military families than any other segment of our population. They're available to everything under the VA chain, as well as everything else we bring to bear, but making sure that it is not a lack of awareness that is driving that 3 in 10 number. And lastly, invigorating our own core operations. If we don't run our own programs well, we won't have any hope at doing the larger leadership advocacy and partnerships. So making sure that we re-energize our Veterans Home Loan Program after the recession, making sure that we bring that back both as a benefit but also as a key financial support for the agency. We'll have an update a little bit later here on the Oregon Veterans Homes, but making sure those are well-run, financially sustainable, and providing excellent quality health care and support to our veterans. Making sure that we invest in our IT, that we invest in our HR, and that we invest that we make sure that we are fiscally prudent and sustainable for the long run. So these goals, again, are still very high level, and I'll just call out one on the target veteran services. Focus statewide veteran services on training, claims, review, advocacy, and support. Just on that training one, we blew that up into a two to three page policy option package for the e-board to consider. And we finally doubled our training capacity. We had Mitch Sparks in the back here and then Gus Bedwell. Can you raise your hand, Gus? We poached Gus from OSU, and where he was the veterans coordinator, and we will make sure that gets backfilled to key support at OSU. But the capacity for us to train our county veteran service officers, long-time challenge, and just one example of how we're going to continue to dig in one by one on these suckers to make sure that we're actually taking them from the high-level concepts that they are, taking what the Secretary of State's audit and review found, incorporating that into these strategies. They all fit and they all align with them, but continue to go deeper with our team. And I would just say it's a 2014 to 2019 plan, so we're already beginning to implement that, whether on the training request, whether out of the $1 million Veterans Outreach Grant that the legislature passed out of 2013, moving to electronic claims filing. We had a federal VA Highly Rural Transportation Grant to the tune of $400,000 to make sure rural veterans are able to access health care, increasing the number of claims, increasing the compensation, making sure that we are doing data sharing, the initial ones across BOLI and DMV and DHS, and then investing in the technology to make sure it's not just an Excel spreadsheet that we're tracking these things on, but that we have a robust data sharing and data effort. We're now co-hosting the Veteran Service Provider Summit with the National Guard, and a lot of efforts on that awareness with email subscriptions, news blogs, CVSO websites pushed down to the local level, social media marketing, our benefit magazine, and now even our annual report from the advisory committee. Never before really using it as a tool to say, hey, this is what we do, whether to the governor, to the legislature, to our stakeholders. But we are both incredibly proud of where we are as an agency, as a state serving veterans, but also recognize how much work is in front of us, but excited to deliver on our plan and happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, this may be more of a question for Mitch, I'm not sure, but in VSO training, is there a segment in there on when that individual goes back into the community they're going to serve, how they market the services they have? Are they trained on how to go on to morning radio shows and local radio markets and and run public service announcement ad campaigns on radio and in newspaper? Is there a segment on them going back into their markets and promoting the services that are available?
So I would say the heaviest focus is on those, the core focus on the federal statutes and the rules on the disability claims and on the healthcare regulations. But a huge component to the work on the softer side of it, whether it's how do you host outreach events and tap into women veterans, how do you do that outreach and awareness and marketing? But I think it's between the two of them, I'd say those softer ones are the weaker area of our training and an area that we can continue to improve. The CVSO websites were one way, knowing that your lone county veteran service officer might not have the capability to make their own website and generate content. We don't want to recreate the wheel. So where the state leverages the federal VA, let's see where the counties also could leverage, whether on PSAs or on other outreach tools, but definitely.
Representative Esquivel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted you to be aware, and I'd like everyone else to be aware of, that we have an organization in Southern Oregon called the Southern Oregon Veterans Benefit. And the Southern Oregon Veterans Benefit organization is a 501c3, and right now we are raising money to put a replica of the Vietnam Wall permanently in Medford, Oregon. It'll be a 50% size. It'll be approximately 5 feet tall by, I think, 250 feet long. It has all 58,240 some names on that wall. We're also going to sell bricks that will have people's names on it that are part of that wall. Example, I went to school with a kid that was a good friend of mine that right out of high school, he was in country for 3 years and was a KIA. So I'm going to buy one for him. But you can go, if you'd like to donate to that, to sovb.com. And you can, in fact, put money into that. It's about $250,000 venture. But I think that we, as Southern Oregon, we can raise that money. And if you had just $5 from every veteran in Oregon, you'd have more than enough. So, and why do we have that wall? Because we Vietnam veterans, a lot of us felt we weren't supported by our government, we weren't supported in the field, we weren't supported at home, and a lot of us were treated very poorly when we came home. This wall is a healing process, not only for the veteran, but for society as a whole. We realize in the last couple wars that you don't take it out on the warrior just because you don't like the war.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, Representative Esquivel, we are in as strong a position as we are largely because of the Vietnam generation stepping up for our most recent veterans. The most powerful statement of never again will one generation of warriors and veterans turn their back on another generation. That peer-to-peer support across our veterans community is huge. And a good chunk of our work is this, the memorials, whether from the Vietnam generation or World War II to today, sometimes can seem more symbolic, but it is powerful to see the effect that these memorials and honor and recognition have on that transition and healing process as our veterans come home. So thank you.
Yes, follow up.
The interesting thing about this is that it will be the only Vietnam wall on the West Coast. The closest one to us, there's one in Oklahoma, there's one in Texas, and then you have the one in Washington, D.C. Many of our veterans can't go to Oklahoma, Texas, or Washington, D.C., so they'll have an opportunity on the West Coast, at least, to be able to come and visit that wall.
Thanks for bringing that forward. And again, on behalf of your friends in this committee, welcome home to you and all your other veterans from the Vietnam era. Thank you, sir. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Cameron, I want to go back to something you were saying about the kind of comparison to Oklahoma, that they generate $400 million more in direct veteran benefits than we do. If they have kind of roughly the same population size, or do they have the same kind of gap in terms of if we've got 100,000 or so veterans who are in Oregon are currently connected with ODVA, we have another nearly 250,000 who are not connected at some point. Like, is that gap, their service gap between who they're serving and who's unaccounted for by census numbers or whatever numbers that you're using, is wide as in Oregon, and how much more kind of room to grow do they have compared to how much we have? Because I'm trying to get a sense of if we're serving 100,000 Oregonians, and they're getting their benefits, and it's $2.2 billion and $1 billion of direct benefits that's being spent out in the economy, and we have a gap to close. Like, if in increments, I mean, how much do you think we start closing that gap, do we generate? So what's the difference between us and Oklahoma in terms of how many more people they're serving than we are to have gotten to that $400 million mark?
So Chair Matthews, members of the committee, Representative Parrish, I think I'd have to dig in a little bit further, but they are definitely deeper in their penetration of veterans. Whether that gets them to a 4 in 10 metric or not, I don't think so, but they're definitely serving deeper. And having a little more coordination, we are a strong county system here that we honor and want to empower, but we don't always have the lines. We have to build the lines to make sure that it is still one county, state, seamless system, where in Oklahoma it is state veteran service officers that are then regionally placed around the state. So a little bit of a different model. On the beyond, $400 million is enough for us to go out and conquer. We feel that momentum. We feel that in that focus. That is enough for us to go out and get. How much more are they leaving on the table, I think, is a good question. And then what's always been harder for us to quantify, given data systems that the state agencies don't always cross over well, and both from us and from other agencies. But what does that then mean in terms of veterans that either get identified through the Paris program or other state safety net services, or maybe incarcerated justice-involved veterans? What does that capture? I mean, that's going to be in the billions of dollars, but it's just not a hard and fast quantifiable number that I can put on the table.
Can I just follow up? So I just want to clear one statistic. So we're serving 3 in 10. They're serving 4 in 10. Is that what I heard you say? And that the gap is, or that their kind of additional is the $400 million.
So Chair Matthews, Representative Parrish, we'd have to double check in terms of their percentage, but it's a deeper, they are serving deeper, and whether it bumps them up to a 4 in 10, I don't think so, because most of the states are in that 3 to 10 bucket, okay. Kind of a rough 30% to a third of their veterans. But a little bit deeper, a few percentage points, gets you significantly more number of veterans that you're serving.
One last quick.
Sure.
So Mark was stationed at Fort Sill, and Oklahoma's definitely a very strong, you know, military community anyway. How much does having an active base like Fort Sill in a state like Oklahoma that's making that kind of impact have a difference versus a state like Oregon where we have no base?
Chair Matthews, Representative Parrish, always hard to compare state to state. We do not have those large military bases, but we do have a strength in that we have that, you know, every state has a National Guard, but we have a stronger relationship with our Guard than most states. It's a gap not having military bases here and that center of gravity like a Fort Lewis or San Diego or Fort Sill or North Carolina. Oklahoma has weaknesses in not having as many medical centers from the VA side, though, so they have a less number of veterans than we do getting access to health care. We tap into Walla Walla, to Boise, to Roseburg, to Pill Hill at Portland VA. So there are different comparisons, but one of the, and it will kind of come up in some of the later testimony here on issues, one of the frustrations, yes, we are that powerful advocate about federal VA and tapping into Department of Defense, but so much opportunity just in our own lane of state and county for us to serve veterans. We need to continue to be that advocate and encourage where we can to grow, whether it's the Guard presence, whether it's the federal VA presence, but simply better tapping into what already exists, both at VA, Veteran Services System, and the partnerships. There is enough in Oregon that we can tap into right now to better serve.
Great. Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cameron, budget request for 15-17 that the department passes on to counties for CVSOs. What's the request going to be, and or is it going to be the same as 13-15, plus or minus? Where are we going to stand?
So Chair Matthews, members of the committee, Representative Huffman, don't want to get too far out in front of the governor's budget process, but our agency did submit our agency request budget that gets fed into budget and management, and then ultimately the governor will make some final decisions around November and then come up with governor's recommended budget usually printed around December. The way they framed it out is typically you're able to ask for about 20% more than your general fund allocation for your current allocation. So we're in about that $9 to $10 million of general fund. So where we are using those limited resources, we're using that framework to make those what we tee up. So we see significant $1 million outreach grant dollars that flow down. We want to always maintain that $3.5 million pass-through to the counties. That is our regional network. But out of this 13-15 budget, the $1 million outreach grant that has already begun to see great success for the same comparable quarterly period, about 16% more new power of attorneys, which equal more claims going up to the feds. And that was based on one-time funding. We've seen such great strengths come out of that program that we want to make sure that we continue that forward. Our e-board request for the additional training position for Mr. Gus Bedwell, that is our number one priority, to keep that one going. But again, that doesn't carry forward automatically, so we request that. We have some general fund debt capacity to make sure that we pay off the bonds on the Lebanon Veterans Home currently being built out. I'm trying to think of the other ones in the mix. Mobilizing partnerships is a how do you begin to structure yourselves to actually do that, to be able to have that hand come out when a partner, whether a nonprofit or a fellow state agency. So looking at bringing on two policy analysts, both in a health and wellness perspective and education economic opportunity, that would be a huge center of gravity for us to, we always talk about busting down these silos. It does take staff and resources to do that. We've also proposed some investments on the technology side. But where we feel limited, because it is, you got to make limited choices with those 20%. If I had to go above and beyond that 20%, we want those dollars going down to the local level where they can make the most impact. We have never been as well aligned with our county partners. The Association of Oregon Counties has now called out, just like this committee called itself out from Human Services and called itself out as a Veteran Service Committee, additionally with the Military and Emergency, both on the House and Senate. AOC now has that as its own committee process. Commissioner Diane McKeel out of Multnomah County has been leading that charge. But again, a diverse group of, we have never had that alignment with ODVA in the counties, both the opportunity where it feels like legislators have a good idea of our work, the county commissioners have a good idea of our work. We made a significant infusion in 2005 to the tune of that $3.5 million. Before it was just $10,000 grants to counties for their, it was all county-funded VSO efforts. As we see counties struggle, as we see the outcome and the potential for leverage of these limited dollars, drawing down more of those federal resources, it always takes a time and a place to get anything done big, both from a policy perspective and from a budget perspective. But it feels like the time is right in the 15-17 budget to make a significant investment. We could double the county pass-through of $3.5 million and make a significant impact community by community. And then making sure as we continue to implement the framework that we're actually getting, this is a proven system that we're getting good outcomes for. We're all trying, a lot of state agencies, whether across healthcare, the justice system, we're trying to create that navigator model. We have had that since World War II with the county and state veteran service officer network. They're proven, but I don't know that we've ever truly funded their ability to be in an office, ride a desk, take those appointments day in and day out, and also be that linchpin in the community that we need to drive the engagement. So I don't want to overpromise of what's possible, but it feels like the time is right.
Just follow.
Sure.
I always keep an eye on it. A couple of biennia back, the budget requests came in lower, and so I had to scramble to try to, I happened to be co-chair of that budget at the time, and piecemeal something together so that the money to the counties didn't get cut. And so it's something every biennium I come back and ask, where are we? Because I want to make sure that that does stay whole or plus side.
Chair Matthews, Representative Huffman, you'll have some strong support and vocal support from the local electeds and the CVSOs to make sure that's the case, and from us.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions on this issue? Cameron, I think you're going to be spending quite a bit of time with us this morning.
Chair,
you have a few things to touch on.
Yeah. Members of the committee, if if you're willing, we do have the CEO, Dwight Holton from Lines for Life. I'd like to also call him up for his kind of expert testimony as well. But if I could kick off the issue, we've often been dealing with suicide for all citizens and then veterans as a specific population. I encourage folks to look at subject matter experts. The Oregon Health Authority and the Public Health Division does an annual report specifically focused on veterans. We're always about a year behind in terms of the data. So this one was 2008 to 2012, came out in May. And just to give a picture of what we've seen over those 4 years of 2008 to 2012, suicide is the leading cause of death among veterans under 45 years of age. We often see a statistical bump up compared to the non-veterans population, both in younger veterans and in older veterans, and that mirrors the civilian population. But where we are, only that 1 in 10 number for Oregonians, veterans in Oregon, we are approximately 23% of all suicides across the state. 97% of those suicides, and that works out to about 150 suicides by veterans every year. 97% of those are male veterans, so very heavily skewed to the male population. Since 2001 through 2012, we've had an increasing rate of suicide among veterans, but not because of the raw numbers. It's roughly always about 150 veterans per year, but we've been decreasing. As you lose that World War II and Korea population, that 150 is of a smaller total population number. So the rate has been increasing, but the total number per year on year has been relatively constant. So it's not a tsunami of newness, but it is statistically, you know, we are double. When we talk about overrepresentation, we are overrepresented in suicides across Oregon. Firearms are the most common mechanism of injury. We've seen regionally, not surprisingly given some of the mental health and healthcare capacities in rural Oregon, but Coos, Curry, Jackson, Klamath, and then in Lane and even here in Marion County have higher rates compared to even their other counties. But what we know is there's no one answer there's no one cause and there's no one answer to suicide, but it's not something that we're going to run from, and we need to talk about it and we need to address it as one of our issues. Want to introduce Dwight Holton, CEO of Lines for Life, and let him talk about their work in partnership with some state funding out of this last biennium.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here. My name is Dwight Holton, and I, as of 6 months ago, took the helm of Lines for Life. For those of you who know, all of you, I know my predecessor, Judy Cushing. I have the smallest, tremendous shoes to fill ever. But Judy and I have been working very closely on transition. It's been going terrific. One of the most exciting projects, Cameron got to tell you the bad news, the challenge that we face around veteran suicide. The good news is that we're making tremendous strides in our efforts to reach more and more veterans with the Veterans Suicide Crisis Line initiative that you and the Department of Veterans Affairs have crafted. We're thrilled to be up and running. We have a snowballing volume of people we are reaching. We've more than doubled in the first quarter alone that we began this. We've been going for two quarters now. We more than doubled the number of veterans we were reaching to 434 in that first quarter. 337 in the first quarter, 434 in the last quarter. We've grown about 25% just in the last quarter. I think that snowballing demand reflects the depth of the need. And we're reaching people really across the board. The most pressing issues, I would say the three things we hear most from people about are post-traumatic stress, relationship issues, and drug and alcohol challenges. The vast majority of drug and alcohol challenges are actually alcohol with a fairly limited amount of drug challenges. But our callers are regularly reaching these people we're there 24/7, 365, often with peers. We try to have the line staffed by peers, people who've been there, and you can better relate to people who have that different experience of military stress as opposed to stress that comes from everyday life. We have a very exciting program that's been in place for a while, but is really growing now, and I'm hoping to grow with my background in law enforcement in cooperation with the Portland Police Bureau, Marion County Sheriff's Office, and Salem Police. We have volunteers on the lines from those three police forces who both go through the significant amount of training at 60 or 80 hours of training that we have folks do for the lines, but then they get day-to-day experience on the crisis lines working with people in crisis. It makes them better able to do their jobs in a safe and successful fashion. The head of the crisis intervention team for Portland Police describes a total sea change in the way they approach people with crisis. In crisis, 10 years ago, he would tell you that their definition of success was leaving with someone in cuffs and no one shot. Now their definition of success is the SWAT team doesn't have to roll out at all. The crisis intervention team doesn't have to roll out at all because they've helped walk line officers through how to de-escalate without putting anybody in custody. So we're very proud of that aspect of this. We think it's really important as well. The growth in our reaching veterans is directly attributable to the ODVA and state initiative around the Veterans Crisis Suicide Line. We've undertaken an aggressive marketing campaign supported by the state that's included thousands and thousands of broadcast ads. In June alone, we had over 5,000 ads broadcast on AM, the top AM and FM stations around the state. And by the way, that came with a 75-to-1 return on investment. For every ad we paid for, we got 75 donated for free through our public-private partnerships with our communications partners. We've also had a significant TV presence. We unveiled a new TV spot during the Blazers playoffs, which has been picked up by stations all over the state and put in regular rotation. But beyond that, we've also had a boots-on-the-ground effort that I'm really proud of. We have six folks, including three Vet Corps volunteers. Vet Corps is a program of AmeriCorps, Vet Corps coordinators, I should say, who have been divided the state into regions and who have been doing an aggressive boots-on-the-ground effort. And we were trying to figure out how to capture this for Cameron and the other folks at ODVA when we were giving our quarterly report, and we were back talking to some of the folks who'd been out doing these boots-on-the-ground visits, and somebody opened a file, and this was what was in it. This is 1 week, notes from 1 week trip, and I'll hand it up with the leave of the chair. Representative Boone, you'll find some of your district there, I think. It's incredible. It's libraries, it's American Legions, it's directions after directions, and notes about must find this person at this place. It's just a really campaign-like effort, which is exactly what we need in order to reach people, and we're undertaking it. I guess the last thing I would point out is that our public-private partnerships and capacities as a NGO, as a nonprofit, have really amplified the state's support here. And I'll give you just one example. Les Schwab is a tremendous supporter of Lions for Life and a tremendous supporter of efforts to reach veterans. They have, first of all, donated basically one out of every four ads they run during Trailblazers games are our military PSA, our PSA for the military helpline. But then they're also helping on the boots on the grounds effort. They're putting promotional materials in their nearly 200 showrooms throughout Oregon. So that's the kind of leverage you get with the public-private partnership that we bring. I'm really thrilled to be in this line of work. I enjoyed being in law enforcement for as long as I was, but what I found in that job, putting people in prison for many, many years, and loved every minute of it, I have to say, was that nearly every single one of those stories began with either substance abuse or mental health crisis sometime years before. And with this current adventure, I'm trying to figure out how we get into the story earlier to prevent the victimization, prevent people from coming into the system in the first place. And this effort is a tremendously important part of that. I'll leave you just with one thing. Behind all these numbers, there are faces, of course. Every single one of these people, 434 callers last month, is a real person with a real challenge. Most of the people we hear from, close to 90%, are new callers, but a small portion are repeat callers. One is a guy from Portland who lost two sons in camp combat 9 months apart within the last 12 months. As the one-year anniversary of his first son's death approached, he relapsed into a long-time dependence on alcohol. This summer, he regained his sobriety and uses us as his sounding board when times get tough. That's the kind of people you're reaching every day with your investment with us, and we deeply appreciate it. And I'm happy to take some questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, if I can just quickly. One other portion, so we had a $350,000 RFP contract that did line up for Lines for Life. They also have the support of the Addictions and Mental Health Crisis Line from OHA. Another piece of that 2013 legislative cycle beyond the budget was Senate Bill 762 in 2013, directing ODVA to establish a veteran suicide prevention and outreach program. So what we heard, a lot of outreach and a lot of marketing through this public-private partnership with Lines for Life and all they bring to bear. Also hugely helpful, given that it's outside the chain of command from VA and DOD. There's sometimes that access. Folks want something that's completely distinct. But then we also, so the direction on Senate Bill 762 was to establish a suicide prevention and outreach program at ODVA, can accept any appropriation. Also innovatively was able to get, now every time that an Oregonian re-registers or registers online with the DMV for their vehicle registration, now it asks, would you like to make a donation in support of preventing veteran suicide? Which then links over to our donation site. We've historically focused donations from the community very heavily on the Veterans Home, both in the Dalles and standing up in Lebanon. But historically, it's been one of the more self-sustaining pieces of our program area financially. So now we're looking at expanding that to four buckets to focus on suicide prevention, Veterans Home, women veterans efforts, then in a catch-all veteran service one. Representative Parrish gave us a hard time when we launched the marketing efforts on the donation, saying, what's next, a bake sale at ODVA? But it is an honest assessment that there is a sea of goodwill across Oregonians. And I think we can continue. We are going to steal some of the partnerships from Lines for Life eventually with the Blazers, with the
We're happy to share. Plenty to go around.
But right now, so now we are on the charitable checkoff for suicide prevention for veterans efforts, as well as for the Veterans Home, along with the donation site. So just in the last year, about $10,000 off of the charitable checkoff from tax refunds, folks donating to that effort, and about $4,000 on the donation side. So we're going to be using those very limited dollars to augment what's coming from Lines for Life. Really highlighting, again, within the system of VA's, DOD's major line, another good partnership. When you call that National Veterans Crisis Number or the military helpline nationally for VA and DOD, when they are overtapped in their main call center out of New York, it bumps. Well, first, I think Oregonian calls bump to Lines for Life.
Yes, that's right.
Immediately. And then when they get overwhelmed nationally, they are another one for that overflow network. So kind of some good synergies.
That's right.
We're going to have to use, again, try to get a lot of free media out of that $10,000 media buy and really use it targeted both for the demographics and specifically the regions most heavily affected by this suicide.
And thank you for being here, and thank you for comments and your work on this very important issue. And as is said in the media, a high-profiled and high-powered individual leading us now. And thank you for your work there, and thanks for your service that you continue to lend to the state. It's greatly appreciated. Questions, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The electronic media leverage you were talking about, is that the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, NCSA campaign?
It is, and they're tremendous partners that we are continuous. They just keep setting the bar higher. You know, we will make a little buy and it comes back huge, and they've been tremendously helpful partners for us.
Little known secret I've tried to share with a lot of agencies for programs that they have, so I'm glad you found it.
Any further questions from the group? Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Chair.
All you're doing, and thank you on this.
And I'll hand this up if you'd like to see it. It's really impressive.
That'd be great. I think. Is it? Can we leave it over? There we are. Next up, we have Cameron Smith, Director of ODVA.
I am crossing, Chair Matthews, members of the committee, I'm crossing myself off the December agenda and throwing my staff members up here.
I know that we're asking a lot of you today, and it's a lot of information to share, but to be honest, we have to keep veterans at the front of every discussion.
It's huge.
And the more opportunities to talk and discuss these things, the better off we'll be to set the table as we move into the new year.
So Chair Matthews, members of the committee, next on the agenda, we had a legislative task force. You know, we had a lot of task force grow out of the executive branch and former Governor Kulongoski's efforts, along with my predecessor, Director Jim Willis. This was a legislatively directed task force specifically focused on women veterans, and then even more narrowly targeted specifically on women veterans' health care. Right now, as we talked about earlier, about 9% of all veterans in Oregon are women veterans. And as we see these decreasing populations, both overall for the veterans population, as we lose World War II and Korea and different groups, women veterans are the fastest demographic in the vets pop that is rising. So over the next 20, 30 years, we're going to see a doubling of veterans, both or serving women serving in the military and then becoming home, reintegrating back home as veterans. Given that the focus of the report was on women veterans' health care, much of the recommendation, both the findings and the recommendations are largely on that federal VA system. So a lot of different recommendations on up to the federal VA level. Right now, we've got about 28,000, over 28,000 women veterans in Oregon, across the nation, 24 million veterans. And just an important group for us, has been an underserved group, both on claims, disability pension, benefits, and on the healthcare side. Won't walk through every recommendation and finding out of the report, but a really diverse group that was assembled in 2010. And I want to walk through just the efforts that we see. Often it's a very, you can't hinge off of any one VA system since we tie into Boise, we tie into Walla Walla. But wanted to walk through what Portland VA Medical Center has approached, both through its major medical center and the clinics, to address this rising demographic of women veterans. So right when this report was coming out, I believe it came out September of 2010, was right when the Women's Healthcare Clinic was finally opening up on Pill Hill at the Portland VA Medical Center. So they were establishing the Women Veterans Healthcare Program and actually that Center for Women Veterans Health. And if you haven't visited it, it is, when you pull up to that main building up on Pill Hill, it's a separate and distinct facility that is still easily accessible to parking into the community, but it is its own turf where our women veterans, a group that hasn't always felt comfortable engaging with the VA system, can feel comfortable raising their hand, coming forward, and looking for services. It was about 400 women veterans enrolled when they first started in 2010. Now over 1,500. Allows three full-time female physicians working at the Women's Center, providing gynecology, urology, kind of a one-stop shop where you can get all the services that you need through that women's clinic. Beyond the traditional primary care and health care, also a mental health care capacity and social work in support for our women veterans. An amazing facility up there to support our veterans, and a one to further model, always harder to do in the more rural medical centers, whether Walla Walla or Roseburg. So they're scaled back a little bit in those other communities, but again, a powerful model to follow. Throughout the CBOX in the Portland VA region, also making sure there are designated women's health providers who are trained and proficient in providing women's health care to female veterans. And that helps get it for those that can't access Portland VA Medical Center. It's always that clinic model, and similarly out of Roseburg and the other medical centers, getting that community care that we've seen as a rising percentage of the VA's budget. And given a lot of the political firestorm in VA healthcare this summer and continuing, we'll continue to see that community care model both through the clinics and in the public and private sector. Making sure that women veterans are invited to choose their preferred gender of their provider of healthcare is a critical component of the VA's work going forward. Portland VA Medical Center now has a women's health medical director that works with the program manager and really begins to call out that service for women veterans. They have a robust maternity program that is funded through purchased care, so not within the VA, but purchased by the VA in the community. And a lot of emphasis on sexual assaults. We've seen a lot of it, sexual assaults in the news around college campuses. Historically, it's also been a significant challenge, whether in the military, actively serving military, But military sexual trauma, not simply a women's issue, also affects men to a large degree, but has been a historic, under-recognized issue for our women veterans. And the federal VA, in partnership with a lot of the other folks we've talked about, doing a lot of how do we train community providers for those that aren't necessarily accessing VA care, how do we make sure they're aware of the issues that women veterans may suffer from. Whether military sexual trauma and post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, all the issues that many of our veterans can face. But a lot of good conferences on military sexual trauma. And then the VA has been doing a lot of outreach, whether on the social networking, on the media side. They have put a lot of emphasis onto that outreach and awareness to this underserved population. Before I take any questions, what I do want to emphasize, though, is the focus of our work is on that advocacy and what we can bring leadership from the federal VA, but still a lot that we can do through our own strategic framework to make ourselves better so that we are able to more deeply serve our veterans. And those efforts will be largely focused on underserved veterans populations, whether women veterans, homeless veterans, student veterans, aging veterans, rural veterans, tribal veterans. It is a diverse group. And we simply have to get those roles and responsibilities clarified, making sure we're measuring our outcomes so that we can go deeper serving some very underserved populations of veterans. But happy to take any questions.
Thank you for that. And we're also going to be getting some information on health issues and access to care in the rural area from female veterans. And so we have Ms. Warburton here in just a moment. Any questions from the panel for Mr. Smith? And again, an underserved population, we appreciate you looking at that and realizing how it's growing significantly so quickly. Thank you, sir, and we'll probably save some questions for Ms. Warburton once she makes her presentation.
And Chair Matthews, members of the committee, looking forward to her testimony as well, since not just women veterans, but the rural component, a significant challenge.
Absolutely.
Lastly, a quick update on veterans' homes. So we've had the longtime veterans' home in the Dalles and Representative Huffman's district. Came online in the 90s, 150-bed facility. Wanted to call out most recently, they've always had a full census, has been a self-sustaining program financially. But what makes it amazing is the care that our veterans are receiving there, both from the community support, the professional management from WestCare and the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon, a powerful model of how to do long-term care skilled nursing in Oregon. And most recently, they were called out by the American Healthcare Association and National Center for Assisted Living. We've always been on these best nursing homes in Oregon list from U.S. News and World Report. But most recently, AHCA and NCAL recognized the Oregon Veterans Home in the Dalles, not only for their superior quality outcomes, but also for that continuous process improvement and striving for excellence. And they were one of 24 organizations since 1996 to earn the gold level of the National Quality Award Program. Very much a performance measurement tracking tool, but only 24 across the nation, the first veterans home in the nation to ever receive this, and speaks to the powerful model of the care that our veterans and their families receive at the facility. And if you haven't been to that facility up on the bluff overlooking the dam and the Columbia River Gorge, I got a little nervous when the fire was coming over the hill on the other side of town, but thankfully it was on the other side. But just an amazing facility and one that we are very proud of. Which leads very naturally into the second veterans home, a long time coming for this second facility. Initially, we submitted up in 2008. It's very much a partnership with the federal VA and the local community. 65% construction costs borne by the feds, federal VA. Linn County went out for a local bond to the tune of about $10 million, I believe, where there were some gaps when design changes. Nursing home and skilled nursing facilities are moving from more of a institutional wing model to more smaller community neighborhood pods with their own kitchen, with their own resources, much more of a family environment and a community environment. When those design changes came out, increased the cost, and we were able to get a $4 million supplemental appropriation from the legislature to make up that difference. But now, some 6 years later, finally coming to completion on that veterans home, and what literally was a field of mud down in Linn County in the city of Lebanon is now, it is going to be one of the best facilities in this state, bar none, compared, you know, whether veterans home or any private facility. We're excited. We're going to dedicate the facility September 20th, this Saturday, 11 a.m. kickoff. We'll have a short and sweet ceremony with a lot of electeds from the feds on down, a lot of the community partners that have made this happen. Fortunately, we're not competing with the Beavers game, which is later that night, so we won't run into tailgating traffic. And I do want to call out, it's going to be named after Captain Allworth, who was a World War I Medal of Honor recipient. But when he came home, was then the Memorial Union manager and director at the Oregon State, at Oregon State then Agricultural College, but now the OSU. But just a great, both from the veteran side and the Mid-Willamette side, to have Captain Allworth finally recognized as a Medal of Honor recipient, and also to have his family there this Saturday will be a powerful statement. But happy to take any questions on veterans homes.
Excellent, thank you. Any questions regarding veterans homes? Yes, Representative Huffman, near and dear to your heart.
Cameron, are you going to have, is the report detailed enough to answer some of the questions that we've had about an additional veterans home or two? And
Chair Matthews, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, out of the, again, 2013 session, I believe maybe it was before that even, maybe back to 2012 legislative session, one of our directives was, and appropriations, was to do a study on long-term skilled nursing needs across this population and across Oregon to begin to get a better sense for future direction for our efforts for veterans homes. We're going to formally present that now back to the legislature in December. We'll meet individually with all of you and our Senate counterparts and leadership in advance of that. But I think the general themes are, across all of long-term care and skilled nursing facilities in Oregon, we're at about 60% capacity. So there's a lot of unused capacity that already exists in our system. These institutions are beloved. They provide a center of gravity. They provide excellent care. They draw down construction dollars. They draw down federal VA per diem. But there's also opportunities for us to maximize those federal VA dollars in existing facilities. And the thing that I think the report will caution us on is making sure that we continue not just to meet, where the best placement of these homes are within catchment areas, to make sure that we do have a full census, a full population of veterans and their families, that they are self-sustaining financially, that this doesn't become a burden on the general fund. Because what I find amazing is no general fund dollars, yet we're still getting the excellent outcomes that our veterans and their families and you all demand and expect. We see a lot of other states that have made poor decisions on where to place them from a size or a scale, and then quickly come back with general fund requests, given that they're not meeting the metrics on quality. Those are kind of the highlights, but I think it will be a much more in-depth report that we tee up between now and then formally in December to help guide the work of the 2015 legislature going forward. And the caution, I think, that we feel as we stand up Lebanon, it will be a new facility, it will have single occupancy. 25% of the veterans and families that currently go to the Dalles might live closer to Lebanon and be more naturally aligned to fall in on that facility going forward. We want to make sure that we have a full census at both of those facilities, that we are operating well, both from an outcome and from finances, before pressing forward.
Thank you. Any further questions? Been quite a day. Well, thank you very much for your information. Thanks for your work. You are truly doing an outstanding job as the director of ODVA. I know that it's a lot of weight on your shoulders, a whole lot of responsibility. You've got a great staff that works along with you, and you always give them credit as well. But I just want to say thank you. It's been a pleasure to work with you.
Thank you for all of your leadership. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. And with that, we will move on to the female veterans' health issues and access to care in rural areas. We'd like to bring up Cindy Warburton, please.
Good
And I'll just let the panel know what's great about Ms. Warburton is this comes at the request of our speaker, which kind of shows our speaker thinking about the veterans issues as well. I believe you might be one of her constituents. Not sure. But the reality is I worry that we will find reasons to not have a veterans committee in the future. And veterans deserve their own issues to come forward before their own committee with their own background and understanding. So I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate the speaker's support in bringing you here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I have a presentation. Is there a way to bring that up?
You just clap your hands. And, no, just kidding. And for those of you tracking, we will next take on the update of House Bill 2417. I believe Ryan Fisher and Allison have been waiting. Thank you for your patience. And then we'll be moving on to the implementation of the ORS 408-237, job interviews for veterans. So thank you all. I do appreciate your patience. We have a lot of information. But again, the day to talk about veterans issues is a good day in Oregon. So please.
Thank you, Chair Matthews and members of the committee, for the invitation to be here today. My name is Cindy Warburton, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I practice in a primary care clinic in that community. And this past year, I finished the doctorate in nursing practice degree, which is a DNP at OHSU. And for those of you who might be familiar with that makes me one of those hybrid doctor nurses. Mm-hmm. So as a family nurse practitioner, you may know them as FNPs, and typically, you know, we're registered nurses. We have extra academic training as well as board certification, and we provide, we're certified to diagnose, treat, write prescriptions, and basically manage chronic and acute diseases in our community. And we work across a variety of healthcare environments, from a hospital setting to specialty care, and often in rural communities, we're the only primary care provider for that community. And so for the past 13 years, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has really been this generation's Vietnam War. And so for the first time in our military's history, the fastest growing population of veterans is women. And many of these women have been in direct combat roles. And when they're leaving the military and they're coming home to their communities, they're often not going to, as you've heard, not going to the VA for their health care. They're choosing to come to a community provider for their care. And we may not be well-trained or well-versed in providing the best care for them. And just a background, which many of these numbers you've already heard, but, you know, there's 10% of the women veterans, or 10% of our women are veterans. Sorry, that didn't come out right. The point being here is that the average age of women veterans is young, and it's about 20 years younger than our male veteran population. And one in four are going to be in some sort of combat support role, and one in five, when they're asked about military sexual trauma, they're going to say yes. The top three healthcare issues for our women veterans is musculoskeletal problems, and that's a higher proportion of men of women than men are affected with that. And then endocrine, metabolic, nutrition, that mirrors what the national problem is, and that's diabetes and obesity. And then the third top health problem is mental health and depression, anxiety disorders, often stemming from some sort of PTSD. And in Oregon, as you heard, we have over 25,000 women veterans that live here. And in Central Oregon, which makes up the Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties, we have close to 1,400 women veterans. And of those, only 340 use the VA outpatient clinic there in Bend. And so almost 80% of them are going to community providers such as myself for their health care. And I just would like to take a minute to really emphasize my respect for what the Veteran Health Administration provides for our veterans. It's excellent care. Their standard of practice and the research supports that. And I experienced that firsthand when I was training in an outpatient clinic for the VA. And then as I transitioned back out into the community as a provider, it became very apparent that we weren't so good at screening for military background or whether or not they were veterans, and certainly not providing that high standard of health care that they get when they're in the VA setting. And so as part of my doctoral research, I did a qualitative analysis where I interviewed women veterans and community providers in Central Oregon, and I just collated all of that information and analyzed it for themes and basically came up with recommendations. And this is what I'm sharing with you is just a really high-level look at the research that I did. And I asked the women, where do you go for care? And most of them would use the VA for their specialty service, and then they would use a community provider for their primary care. Or they would do the opposite. They would get all their primary care from the VA, and then they would go and see urgent care or a primary provider for those urgent things because they couldn't get into their primary care at the VA quick enough, but they could get into me as a community provider. I also asked them how they discuss their military experience with their provider, and the short answer to that is they're not, because they're not being asked. So not one of the women that I asked that question to had been asked about their military experience. And now they might have gotten a quick question as they were signing up for the clinic, like, are you a veteran, which is just a yes or no question. And we know we need more information to provide the best sort of health outcomes for them, and that's just not being asked. And part of that is a trust issue. The women may not necessarily feel comfortable talking about their experience because the community, the provider didn't ask or didn't make it apparent that they would want to talk about that. So neither side really is talking to the other, and the bottom line there is the provider's not asking because they think that if it's important that the patient would bring it up. The patient doesn't bring it up because they think if it's important they would be asked. So we have some work to do there. Oops. And there were some varying perceptions of the VA system. Most of them had used it at one point or another. They felt like they were listened to. They were a little uncomfortable sitting in a room full of quote-unquote grumpy old men at the clinic. So, that was all just their perceptions. And most of them felt like the care that they received was good, but they still preferred to go to a community provider for personal reasons, or there was some indication that they didn't understand their VA benefits fully. A comment was made that they didn't want to sign up for VA because they had benefits from the outside and they didn't want to take away from what somebody else might need. So some misconceptions there. And then my questions to the providers were really geared around had they ever worked in a VA clinic, and do they ask questions about their patients? And of course the answer was no, and it really wasn't on the radar. And the bottom line there is that they just weren't really aware that this might even be a problem in the community. And the discussion points of my whole paper really was around how women veterans in Central Oregon, especially in the rural communities, they're going to community providers, they're not accessing the VA, and those community providers are not necessarily addressing their needs as a veteran or even just acknowledging the fact that they were in the military. And that there's a general lack of military cultural awareness among community providers. And as a healthcare provider, and we are trained to really have a good understanding and respect for cultural competency, you know, and the cultural differences of our patients. And I would argue to say that the military culture is not included in that, and it should be. That we need to have a baseline understanding of what it means to have served and how it impacts that patient and their families so that we can have those conversations. Throughout my research, I came up with three very simple and straightforward recommendations that I'm now bringing forward to the community. And I give a similar presentation to the community clinics that I can get into. I'm slowly making my way around to them. And it's really about raising awareness, using some standard screening tools, and then increasing the knowledge of the healthcare community providers so that they can do a better job in caring for our veterans. And I've tapped into the American Nurse Association's campaign called Have You Ever Served? And these are posters that they sent to me freely, so I hand them out to the clinics, and we hang them in the waiting rooms, wherever it's a visual reminder for patients that they can talk about their military experience and also for the providers to remember to ask. The questions for military sexual trauma screening, these are verbatim from the VA, and they use these questions for men and women, and they're required in the VA to ask these questions. And so I encourage the clinics to adopt these questions if they have members or, you know, patients who are veterans or who have served, to go ahead and ask a few more questions. An example of this was I was in the community clinic, and I was seeing a patient for the first time. She'd been in that clinic for a few years. Nowhere in her record was it a veteran, you know, did it indicate that she was a veteran. And it really wasn't on my radar until I asked her a question, and she just said, "Yes, ma'am." And I thought, you know, I just started asking her questions, and through her tears, she told me this whole story about 10 years prior when she was in the military and the event that happened to her that would clearly qualify as a military sexual traumatic event. And she had never talked about it to anybody except her husband. She'd never received treatment. She was not a VA patient and didn't think that she could be. And so with the information I had, I was able to get her connected to our local VA clinic and to our behavioral health counselors so that she could begin to process some of that trauma that she had experienced. And it was interesting because she was actually being treated for chronic fatigue and depression, which she had been treated for a few years, and that is known to be manifest as a symptom of untreated PTSD. So I don't know what the whole outcome of that was, but I hope that those things start to get resolved for her with the right treatment. And then my third recommendation about increasing knowledge of community providers, and again, this is just trying to align with what those needs are. The National Center for PTSD has great online training that's free, and then I give them our local resources that are in our community so that we can connect veterans back to VA-centered services. And before I take questions, I would add that I myself am not a veteran, but I'm married to one. He was, or I should say is, a Marine. And our daughter decided to join the Marines. And so so that's her in the picture next to Chuck Hagel's head. So when she was stationed in Afghanistan last year in December, they were there doing a photo shoot, and Defense Secretary Hagel was there, and they took this picture, and I didn't know. And then a couple months later, they posted it up on Fox News, and it was tied to some other news headline story. But I started getting emails all day, "Is that your daughter?" And so there she is to the left of his head. So my passion to improve the healthcare of women is really a personal one as well for our, you know, to improve the healthcare for our veterans.
So. Thank you for your testimony today and the information that you're sharing, the work that you're doing, and thanks for supporting your daughter as she serves this nation. We appreciate that. I don't know if I sensed it correctly or not, but it seems like thinking about your daughter in this military environment that you're studying now is a bit alarming.
It is, and had I known that she was going to be deployed during the time that I was doing the bulk of my research, I certainly would have chosen a different topic.
Yeah.
I actually chose that topic. It takes a couple years to kind of develop the research that you're going to do, and I chose that because she was in the military, and I not being a veteran myself or not having military experience, I didn't quite understand what it was that she was going through. And so that was very helpful, you know, to understand some of the challenges that are out there. The biggest impact that I see that I can make, and I see this every day in clinic, is patients that come in who have they're veterans, and it's not been talked with about to them, and, you know, from my standpoint as a healthcare provider, nobody's had that conversation with them. Although, you know, they'll go to the VA and they have all these conversations, and then they come to me, and it is helpful if I'm able to go ahead and, you know, have that conversation with them as well, and it develops trust, and they end up getting better care. So that's really the driver of this information, is to reinforce the fact that the community providers out there see a bulk of the veterans, and we just need more information. I think that there just needs to be more awareness out there for folks in the community.
I agree, and I'll bet that as you share your information with other DNPs and FNPs like yourself, that they will find themselves being more effective and more, I guess, trusted amongst the folks they're serving as they share the information they're getting to know. Any questions from the panel? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Warburton, your study appears to be an extremely important one. I think some of the conclusions that I'm about to draw are very troubling. You anticipated one of my comments, is that we need more information. I think we need to drill down on a lot of this. But your study seems to suggest that women who your figures suggested are 1 out of every 10 veterans are, and this is the conclusion I'm not sure about, are generally, as a population, reluctant to go to the VA. Is that accurate?
I would say it is, from my observation and the interviews that I have, and it's for a lot of different reasons. I think that some women are still struggling with identifying themselves as a veteran. If you asked a room full of veterans to stand up, are the women going to stand up with them? I mean, I think that there's still some struggle with that, just that self-identification of being a veteran. And then the other thing that I observed is that it's a young population, and they're busy. They're busy moms. They're busy wives. They don't have time to take care of themselves. Why would they take care of themselves? They've got everybody else to take care of. And I'm in the process of trying to organize a networking group for this fairly young group of women that I've tapped into in Central Oregon so that they can network with each other.
Mr. Chairman, may I
please? Yes, absolutely. Feel free.
Thank you. I've got a feel that there are a number of threads in your study suggesting that this lack of utilization by women of VA services may be in part a selfless act, concerned about their brethren in arms, perhaps needing services more than they do. That troubles me, particularly when your statistics show that the need for medical treatment may, in fact, in many cases, be greater among women. You've now suggested that lifestyles is a challenge, and that's troubling if we have a system set up that doesn't meet people's needs. And I'm concerned that quite frankly, women find the VA an unwelcoming experience for whatever reasons we are unclear about, all of which are troubling, all of which suggest that we need to change this. I'm suspecting, getting a feel, that there's a great deal of cultural change that's warranted here. But as someone who has initiated the study so far, what would you suggest needs to further investigation so that we can get at the heart of this and begin the kind of change that would be necessary to make the VA a welcoming experience for women veterans, and that they can get the kind of care that your research suggests that they need?
Thank you. I think that's a great question. And the first thing that comes to my mind is just getting them connected and providing that the reassurance in a way that makes it easier for them to use those services. In Central Oregon, I heard, well, I don't want to drive to Portland, or I can't drive to Portland, where there's a fantastic women's center set up that could really provide those services. So some of the challenge, I think, is, you know, we can't go into their homes, and I get that, but how do we create something that will work for them where they live, or at least in a hub, such as in Central Oregon? You know, can we have a hub of something that is women's veteran-centric so that they can feel in a safe environment and they feel like they can trust the information that's given and that they'll actually use it?
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think the doctor's onto something here very important, and I think this may warrant some further investigation here in terms of, you know, how can we make a less than good experience on the part of many a better one at this point.
I appreciate that, Representative, and I think that, you know, that was part of the reason why we wanted to put this at the forefront today, too, and have the discussion and the update from Cameron Smith, because the women's health issues are different from men's health issues. We all know that. And the veterans' experience is different for women than it is for men. Just the number of 25% is staggering to me, that 25% of the women would suggest that they have been exposed to military sexual trauma. That's one in four. That's just not, you know, and that number's not going away. And as you look at more and more veterans becoming more comfortable coming forward, you're going to end up with a higher number. It doesn't suggest that's everybody, but it's certainly not everybody else either. So there's a lot of folks that get caught in that net. So it is the mission that lies ahead. And I will not be around to pull on the rope with you. I will do so from outside this building. But for those of you that are going to be here remaining to continue the work, it's clear to me what needs to be done. And that's just continue to march on this issue. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know we've discussed it in committee before, but is it across the board, can veterans go to community health care facilities and get it paid for with their veterans benefits? Is it if they can't or don't want to go to the VAs?
I admit that I am not a complete expert on that answer, but it's my understanding that there are some fee-based programs where they can get services that are outside of the VA and it's covered. But when it comes to primary care, I don't believe that that's the case. And many of the women, actually all of the women that I interviewed, they actually had an external insurance. So it was more that it was their choice, that it wasn't just an option to go to the VA. They had an option to go somewhere else, and they chose to go somewhere else.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
So, at the risk of suggesting that you take on this huge effort that Representative Witt has just outlined, and yourself too. How can we be of assistance, or Cameron in his capacity as director of ODBA, to help out get this in our outreach portfolio, so to speak?
Well, when I was doing my research, one of the challenges that I came across as a community provider was just finding access and tools that the VA, I know that they used in their system, but I couldn't seem to access it from an outsider. And so that's what kind of helped to spark some of this research, was how do I, as an outsider, how am I going to do this? How do I provide this care? And so it would be, and maybe some of it exists now. Most of my research was done prior to this year, but I felt like I couldn't cross that barrier into the VA to tap into some of the wealth of knowledge and practice that they had to apply to my small population of veterans that I might see.
So, final follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So I guess, and you know me, I don't tell people what to do, but I'm guessing that after listening to Director Cameron Smith's just recap of the and the reports, talking about collaboration and partnerships and stuff, there I see an opportunity for partnership here also with the Domestic Violence Network, and just so that, you know, people know when your patients come in and you find a patient like you had who 10 years ago had an event and had dealt with it, that at the very least, you would probably recommend her to go to the local victims assistance programs, the domestic violence programs, et cetera, or some counseling that she might have access to, or whatever your network is. But it should loop into the veteran services also, so that they know and they get a feel for it, rather than, you know, and I don't know how, I'm not an expert in this field, but the more somebody knows about something being a problem in their sector, I think that the more attention it will get in that sense. Mm-hmm. And I trust Cameron to do the right things.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the panel?
For your work. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Representative Esco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes our chair, never mind.
I know it was going to be meaningful.
How many people did you target on this document? How many did you interview?
I had a very small population size comparatively. There was 6 women veterans and 6 community providers. And the reason for that is so that I could actually complete the project and complete the research. I had to go through IRB approval through OHSU, and so I basically was functioning on a really tight time frame, which limited my ability to expand those interviews. So my hope was to get enough rich data that could be inferred to a larger population, at least in Central Oregon. And the people that I interviewed represented each of the counties, and 3 of them were in the very rural counties, and then 3 were in the more populated county.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would think that this committee would recommend that we expand this, because 6 people to me is not nearly sufficient. That there may be even stuff out there that we're unaware of, or she's unaware of, that may be even a greater situation than we are currently are facing. 6 people is not a very large.
No, understood, I mean, Representative.
That's not even a blink.
No, but as I understand. When I think back to 2009, coming in here, and you and I sat together, several of us were in that group. We brought this forward prior to 2010, and I think as I remember, a lot of those testimonies that came forward, a lot of very strong women came forward to tell us about their experiences. Mm-hmm. Before this panel, there were a lot of tears that day, and thinking about how bad this is. So I know that your scope was 6, and we suggest 1 in 4, and that stat comes from greater than the 6 women you talked to. That's a statistic that's out there. But I believe you're right, Representative, and how we do that and how we can fund that again, it's one more thing for this body to recognize the need and then provide the resource to get that done, because this is a very troubling issue. And it's not just because I have 3 daughters that are all aspiring to be something in life. I have yet to know, but I'm worried. Yes.
Yeah, I would suggest that maybe we look at this in the future as something we might want to submit as an option, as a committee bill, to fund something so we can know exactly what we're dealing with instead of what we think we're dealing with.
Understood. Yes, sir. No, thank you for the suggestion. Well done. Any other questions from the panel? Thank you so much for your time. You came all the way from Bend.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. How was the pass? Everything good?
Everything was fine.
Nice and beautiful day. A little smoke in the air.
A little early, but.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Have safe travels home, and really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck to you, and good luck to your daughter. May she come home safely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a review of House Bill 2417. You'll remember it's the Housing Assistance for Veterans. If we could have Ryan Fisher come forward, Community Action Partnership and Oregon Housing Authorities, as well as Allison McIntosh, Oregon Housing and Community Services. Thank you both for being here. Again, appreciate your patience. I know we have some folks waiting to testify on the next issue as well, but thank you. And it's yours. Please introduce yourself and let's begin.
Thank you very much. Chair Matthews, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon and the Oregon Housing Authorities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to give you an update today on House Bill 2417, which started in this committee and was passed in 2013. And it established a dedicated ongoing revenue source to support housing for veterans. We'd like to give you an update on where we are with the implementation of that bill. With me today is Allison McIntosh, who is from Housing and Community Services. She will give you an overview of all of the parts of the bill, but I wanted to start by talking about the portion which is already hit the ground and is in communities and starting to help veterans right now, which is the emergency housing account. And it's 10% of the portion that was created through this bill, and it's for emergency housing. It's for veterans that are either at risk of homelessness or who are experiencing homelessness. As you may recall, when we talked about this bill initially back in 2013, one of the things that was so pressing was, while certainly homelessness is something that we hate to see in any population, we are seeing a greater percentage of it within the population of veterans. One statistic that resonated with myself as well as many of you was that between the ages of 18 and 30, an Oregonian is twice as likely to experience homelessness if they have served their country than if they has not, than if they have not. And that's just not an acceptable, reality. So that was one of the things that motivated this work. The bill was created to build onto existing systems, and there were 3 buckets, if you recall, that funds were to go into. One was for home ownership, one was for affordable rental housing, and then the third is for veterans that are experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness. So that portion that I'm going to talk about is that last bucket there. We call it the Emergency Housing Account. That's a fund that was already established in general fund. What we've done is we've added a requirement for these additional dollars that anyone receiving benefits from those funds meet veteran eligibility criteria. Already we are seeing that this is doing one of the things that we hope that it would do, which is leveraging some of the federal dollars that are coming in to the state to help with this same issue. So the Social Services for Veterans Families Grants, SSVF, some of you may be familiar, are in many regions of the state, and as I reached out to the community action agencies, which distribute the EHA either through direct service themselves or through their local partners, and asked
how are you using the EHA? One of the things that I heard throughout the state was that in areas where there are SSVF grants, sometimes the SSVF grant, it has a very low income requirement, 50% of median income, which in rural parts of the state is extremely low. The emergency housing account allows for 80% of median income. So for veterans who are ineligible for the SSVF grant, this is able to fill some of the holes for folks that are coming in that are needing assistance. That's also being used to help veterans that are trying to find a place to live, maybe have some other supports in place, but they don't have money for a rent deposit or for a utilities deposit. Sometimes they need to repair their credit or they need to get a credit report, and there are some of these very small things, but they're barriers to housing. If you don't have an application fee, you can't put your application in. And these are some of the things that we're seeing the EHA be used for. In addition, it's being used for emergency rent assistance for folks that are at risk of being evicted, and in some cases, case management for folks that have more complex situations and need to manage a lot of different things simultaneously. One of the things that we have seen through the implementation of this bill is we're seeing a lot more collaboration amongst stakeholders. And by that I mean that earlier in this hearing you heard reference to the Association of Oregon Counties and that they have a committee on veterans that has been focusing on this issue. I've been attending many of those meetings on behalf of the housing authorities and the community action agencies. There are now, at the last call that I was at, a housing authority director from Hood River was on that call himself, and we're getting more direct engagement between the community partners and the veteran organizations. We also are working to reach out to ODVA in their strategic plans of trying to get more community engagement and using this as an opportunity to create that engagement. So trying to get better links between someone who comes into a community-based organization for emergency rent assistance or some other social service at that agency and making sure that they're getting connected to their CVSO. So that's still an aspirational goal and something we're working toward. And bringing ODVA in to talk to Community Action Directors, the statewide association, as we hope to do at our next full meeting, is the sort of thing that is coming out of the work that went behind this bill and then coming out of the implementation of it. So that's a brief overview of how this is getting rolling. I'm happy to take any questions. I have some specific information about how this is being used in some of your areas. I'd be happy to talk with you about that offline or here if you'd like to ask about it.
Great. So any idea like what kind of balance we're talking about that's been collected so far? Is there...
Allison from Housing and Community Services.
There we go. I jumped in front of you.
Numbers. I know that we've had about $140,000 to date for that emergency housing account,
okay.
And that's the first two quarters of collection. So that's half of a year, and she can get into more detail on that.
Great. And why don't we hear from Allison, okay. And then we'll go to questions.
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And the agency I work for provides stable and affordable housing and engages leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and opportunity for Oregonians. In 2013, when House Bill 2417 passed, it added the $5 to an existing document recording fee to help ensure veterans had a safe place to call home. The original document recording fee, as Ryan said, was passed in 2009, and the funds created by that fee, as well as the additional $5 for veterans, go to Oregon Housing and Community Services and are divided by percentage. As Ryan said, 10% to the emergency housing account to prevent and end homelessness, 14% to address affordable home ownership options, and the rest, 76%, to create affordable housing developments across the state. So the bill went into effect on January 1st, and we began collecting the additional $5. And to date, we've collected 6 months' worth of funding. It comes from the counties a quarter at a time. And we've collected nearly $1.4 million in funding for veterans. The collections are down slightly from our projections, but we believe that may be cyclical, and we're watching that closely. Since the passage of the bill, HCS has been working with partners to determine the best uses of funds, and in particular to ensure that the funds are using existing programs and partners to really ensure that the money is going to increase capacity to better serve veterans. We've been talking closely with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as county veteran service officers, as well as housing providers that have expertise in serving veterans. And we really want to ensure that we're meeting the most pressing needs of veterans in our communities. As Ryan said, the first funds went out the door on July 1st through the emergency housing account, and we've distributed about $140,000. Those funds are divided by formula, and Ryan described how the community action agencies are using those. The other two pots of funds for homeownership and the general housing account are accumulating so that we can roll them out with enough dollars to really make an impact. To date, we've received just over $194,000 for homeownership, and we're currently considering three uses for those funds: down payment assistance for veterans, either through nonprofit housing providers or through ODVA and their OR Vet loan. Last year, ODVA funded 32 loans that would have met our program income criteria. The second possible use would be mortgage payment assistance for returning veterans who are either un- or underemployed. We have a pretty successful program at HCS right now that we're working on modeling this after and are trying to do some estimates of how much it would take to really make this an effective program. And then adaptability. We know veterans have homes that may need to be adapted to continue to be accessible to them if they have had an injury or a disability. And we have partners across the state who currently do this good work to add ramps, to add shower grab bars, to widen doorways, or to provide other critical health and safety repairs. And then lastly, we're still thinking hard about the development of affordable rental housing. To date, we've received just over $1 million for this, and we're talking to partners about the best ways to serve veterans with this type of housing and considering two uses. One would be a kind of permanent supportive housing model where you would develop a small project, 6, 8, 10 units that would have both housing and services for veterans. And then we're also considering larger scale developments where there's a few units for veterans set aside within the development. As you probably know, developing affordable housing requires some significant capital funds, and so these will be the last funds to go out the door. In the meantime, we're really continuing to see increased partnerships between housing and service organizations, the CVSOs, and other veteran service organizations. And we believe our partners are starting to learn more about CVSOs and the VA system, how to better serve veterans already living in their housing, and how to ensure veterans are receiving the benefits that they're entitled to. Lastly, I just want to mention that we're actually convening the Rules Advisory Committee this Thursday, and we're going to be discussing the last pieces of implementing the homeownership dollars as well as the development dollars. And that committee includes representatives from ODVA, County Veteran Service Officers, the Federal VA, and other housing organizations that serve veterans. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. Thank both of you. Any questions? You know, I just want to say this House Bill 2417 kind of went through, and it was kind of one of those silent type things. I mean, a lot of work done behind the scenes, a lot of quietness. Some people were probably opposed but didn't want to be opposing veterans. They understood the impact it could have. I think all along I've always felt this might be one of the most significant things that this committee has done for veterans. And while he's sitting in front of me, I want to say again publicly, Ryan Fisher, thank you, sir, for your help on this issue. You were at the helm. You led the charge. You held the groups. You went to meetings, doors closed. You took this all on, and we look like heroes for pushing a button. But at the end of the day, you, sir, deserve the thanks. And I appreciate your work. Allison, your work as well, very instrumental. But take back to your groups, please, our thanks. I think about, you know, $1.4 million over two quarters. What potentially this is going to be, and that's down from what we thought we'd be, and the impact this will have on Oregon. This is great work. It's going to have a huge impact, and it's going to affect a lot of folks, whether they're going to buy a home, rent a home, or just about to lose one and save one. So, again, bottom of my heart, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you. You deserve a ton of the work, a ton of the credit in all this great work. Thank you very much. And with that, I think we are ready to let you leave the panel. But thanks again, and keep up the great work, and hope the family's well.
I just want to thank you very much for those kind words, and also I want to thank you. I want to thank you, Representative Esquivel, your husband, Representative Parrish, and Representative Huffman, for your service to this country. It's an honor to have worked on this bill with you and with this committee, and what the work I did is nothing compared to the sacrifices that you have all been prepared to make. Thank you.
We'll make that your last words. Thank you so much. Appreciate that, Ryan. Well done. And if you flip the page, we're continued. We get a little update on the implementation of the job interviews for veterans. And I think at this point we'll bring up Paloma Sparks, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Lori Skillman, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and Andy Smith, Association of Oregon Counties. If you could please come forward. Looking forward to hearing what we're going to hear today. I think we've got an issue here that potentially troubling. We have one that we are hoping we'll gain consensus on as we look forward to 2015. Yet I also understand that it is rather complicated, and there are folks that are trying to implement this to the best of their abilities with a lot of questions. And I think one of the most frustrating things from a veteran standpoint is the rules of engagement have to be the same wherever they go in this great state. And so trying to find some collective agreement on how this is going to be applied in terms of veterans' preference would be greatly appreciated. If we can't get there as a group, then I'll bet this group will figure it out. So with that, let's start. And if we wouldn't mind, how about we'll start with have you discussed amongst yourself, or we just start with ladies first? We'll go with Paloma.
Good morning, for the record. Chair Matthews, member of the committee. My name is Paloma Sparks. I'm with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We want to thank you for the opportunity to update you on the progress of the work group. The mission of the Bureau of Labor and Industries is to protect employment rights, advance employment opportunities, and protect access to housing in public places free from discrimination. This includes protecting veterans' rights in hiring and employment. We also work hard to inform employers of their obligations under the law and to make it as easy as possible for them to comply with the requirements of the law through our trainings, materials, and hotline. BOLI is committed to ensuring that veterans have a fair and meaningful shot at a job while providing clarity to employers seeking to navigate Oregon's law. We were assigned to lead the work group. We met over the summer with stakeholders from state and local government and various other interested parties to discuss the issues of implementing the laws regarding transferable skills and veterans' preference. Early on, we all reached consensus that everyone's goal is ensuring that veterans are being afforded opportunities to compete for public sector jobs, and we're given a chance of how to demonstrate how their transferable skills qualify them for those jobs. We discussed many issues. We tried to focus. We spent a lot of time working on how to narrow and clarify definitions in the law, how to consolidate the laws so that they made sense together. There was a lot of confusion about the laws sort of being separate and not seeming to interact very well together, so we worked on that. Subgroup met to sort of work on policy statements and definitions. I think that led to a lot of great discussion. I think that we have a lot of areas of agreement. BOLI's position is that every qualified veteran should be interviewed, and that the preference should apply at every stage of the process. That is how we currently interpret the law. Part of the reason for that is that we want to make sure that every veteran's got a chance. We also want to make sure that even if there are multiple stages of interviews, that they are really given a preference throughout that process, because the initial interview could be just a pro forma process instead of a real interview. So we want to make sure that that continues throughout the process. That has been the agency's position for some time, and that is the only, I think that is a sticking point that the work group landed on, but overall I think we've got areas of agreement, and we are happy to continue to have discussions about what would be the best way to implement this law and if there are other fixes to be made. We believe that veterans who've served our country have tremendous talents to offer our state and stand ready to protect their rights while providing support and clarity for employers, including other agency partners. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paloma, a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is anybody from DAS at the table in these discussions, because they do a lot of the human resources work. The other thing is defining qualified. You had mentioned if a veteran is qualified, and knowing some of the processes that are followed and requirements. I'm on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and I'm continually asking employers, whether it be government or private, be realistic about what your qualifications are. Don't put down that you require a bachelor's degree if a bachelor's degree truly has nothing to do with the job. So qualifications really needs to be defined in this situation. I've run across in one where DAS was performing the work, they were requiring qualifications for a human services related management of a program. And the reality of it is, as a lifetime employer, almost 40 years of being an employer, if I were advertising for that position, I would have wanted somebody that could communicate well, play well in the sandbox with others, self-organized, common sense. Those were the things that needed, and it had nothing to do with a degree or extensive background in running a human services program. So defining qualified is going to be key on this.
Chair Matthews, Representative Huffman, that is an area that we really were trying to work on significantly. The current law says minimum qualifications, but that's not really what employers need. And if you're really trying to make sure that you're in front, you're seeing the best qualified candidates, we wanted to include in qualifications that it included truly what you wanted from your applicants.
To that point, Representative Farish.
I'm kind of curious back to the discussion, though, that we had when we passed this bill, which was that the whole purpose of providing at least the first interview was to be able to accurately describe why you're qualified for that job. Because if you're asking me for, XYZ license and, et cetera, but my military skills, if I had them, or my husband's in this case, don't exactly transfer over, you're still qualified, you just don't necessarily meet the description. And the purpose of that interview was for you to come in plain English and say that, an 88 mic means I can drive a truck for the city of Portland. And that's, at that point, being able to clarify in plain English. That was the real point, wasn't that they meet the, as I remember legislative intent, not that they meet the qualified as posted, but that they are qualified for the job and they get an opportunity to come in and explain to you why they're qualified.
And Representative Esquivel, I will ask, would it be helpful if we heard from the panel first before we, because they might, would that be okay?
I just wanted to say that no matter what we do, we have to be very specific about keeping this even on a playing field, because you can manipulate the criteria at any given time, and we know that it happens. And if I know that Representative Matthews has certain qualifications, I can make that demand for the criteria to fit just Representative Matthews. And that's what we're trying to get away from, because that's exactly what's a lot of people are doing in this state, and they don't hire the veteran because they either have someone picked out or someone's in line. We all know it.
Why don't we continue to hear, and thank you for your comment. Let's continue to hear from the panel if we can. So thank you, Ms. Barks, and please stay around for some questions. And if you will, please, Ms. Gilman.
Good morning, Chair Matthews and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skelman. I'm a senior policy advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I provided the committee with a written report that is a consensus report of the stakeholders that are in the working group. Their names and the organizations that that they represent are part of that report. I present this report on behalf of the 13 stakeholders who represent a broad cross-section of city, state, and county public employers, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, city and county associations, Oregon Employment Department, and Oregon Military Department. Four of the stakeholders on the working group are, in fact, veterans. I won't read the report, but I want to just focus on a couple of key areas of consensus. The first area of the agreement and consensus are the principles that guide the work of this stakeholder group. The stakeholders agree that veterans' preference in employment is valued and important because it recognizes and honors veterans for their service and sacrifice, and it gives special consideration to veterans in a competitive hiring process. Stakeholders also agree that veterans are valued employees because of their rigorous training, specialized skills, sense of teamwork, leadership skills, and the ability to learn new skills. Another principle that the stakeholders agree upon are that the statutes must be clear, unambiguous, and use plain language so that veterans, the public, and employers can all understand the purpose of the statute. The third principle is the method for applying veterans' preference. How you mechanically apply veterans' preference must be easy to understand and implement, must be clear and uniform across all public employers, and it must be stated in the statute. Fourth, getting to sort of the purpose of this particular discussion is the provision in ORS 408-237, which came out of House Bill 3207, which really focused on two things. One, it focused on the interview for the veteran, and second, on these transferable military skills. If those were the focus, and those were that was brand new language that was put in 2011 session, if that is the focus, then the stakeholder group agreed that that focus then must be part of and used as the method for applying veterans' preference. So if you're going to focus on those two areas, they agreed that the focus on the initial interview for the veteran was critical because that was the best opportunity for the veteran to describe their transferable military skills and really help the employer understand how those military skills can be transferred into skills of civilian employment. And then the second piece is that that initial interview gives the employer the opportunity to clarify what the veteran is talking about when they're doing their transferable skills and help them better understand what's required from the employer and how those two things can mesh together. So the initial interview, these stakeholders felt was a real key piece, and we derive that directly from House Bill 3207. And finally, if you use House Bill 3207 as kind of a distinction within the law, then the focus should be on increasing the number of veterans that are invited to the initial interview. And that's where the focus of the committee is. Looking at changes to statute, changes or looking at the issues in the existing statute, the question is always, well, what's the problem you're trying to solve? I mean, what is the problem out there in this particular statute? There are a number of them, but really the most critical ones are there's a lack of clarity in the statute. There's terminology that's not defined, that's new, complicated, and confusing. Existing definitions are poorly defined. The veteran's preference in 408-237 does not mesh with the existing veteran's preference statutes in 408-230. There was no integration when that was kind of tacked onto the statute. The statutes are ambiguous. They are internally inconsistent, and a net result of all of that lack of clarity for veterans, for the public, and for public employers is because it's not clear and there's no uniform method for how to apply veterans' preference, a significant number of lawsuits have been filed by veterans against cities, counties, state of Oregon, and other public employers about this issue. Fundamentally, the stakeholders are telling you that the status quo is not working. It's just not working. There exist honest, reasoned, but fundamental disagreements about the legislative intent on the existing statutes, the statutory interpretation, and the implementation of the law. One of the greatest challenges applying veterans' preference with employers when there are large pools of candidates. Some candidate pools for entry-level positions in a larger city or in the state have 400-plus candidates that are qualified for the job, that meet all the criteria for the job, but say out of that pool of 400, you have 60, 65 veterans. The interpretation of the statute that would require a public employer to interview all 60 of those qualified veterans is really a challenge for public employers. I'm not sure if it's really in the best interest of veterans to just have them do that as some sort of exercise. And it slows down the process, it's very costly, and it's very inefficient. One of the things that the stakeholder group thinks it's very important are what are the policy considerations facing the legislature on these particular issues. The stakeholder group believes that the policies and the legislative intent and the methodology must be included in the statute so that there's no confusion. As I said, there are disagreements about what really was the legislative intent behind some of these provisions. So we would like those statements to be in the legislation. Our own Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs statutes has some legislative intent language in there, and it's very helpful in guiding the agency. So here are some policy considerations for the committee and for the legislature. Should public employers make hiring decisions based on the results of a merit-based competitive process that includes but is not limited to consideration of an applicant's relative ability, knowledge, experience, and skills? Should veterans' preference statutes use plain language? And should they be easily understood by the public employers, veterans, and the public? Should the method for applying veteran statutes be structured in such a way as to give special consideration and greater opportunities to veterans and disabled veterans to be selected for a first interview during the initial phase of the hiring process? Should it also be fair to veterans and all applicants, reasonable for public employers to implement, and provide public employers with some flexibility to design sub-hiring kinds of processes? Should the focus of applying veterans' preference be on the initial interview and be granted once at the time of selecting applicants for that initial interview? And finally, what I would like to ask is I would make a recommendation to this committee that the stakeholders agree that the approaches to resolving the challenges must be carefully considered. The statute is not working as it is. To make changes to that statute must be carefully done and considered by all. The stakeholders would like to have more time to fully develop alternatives and alternative policies in order to present those policies and the alternatives and the alternative methods of implementation so that the legislature can know and understand what the issues are and what the implications of choosing different policies might be. And so we'd like to have the opportunity to continue to work on this and to come back and do an update on this for the December legislative days. Thank you.
Sir?
Chair Matthews, members of the committee, my name is Andy Smith, and I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, where I staff the Veterans Committee and the partnership that we have with the state agency, which is a tremendous partnership we're very proud of, and very fortunate to have Cameron's leadership and his whole team, including Lori, and to be working with Paloma and Boley on this issue. So just a couple of quick thoughts. One would be AOC has an interest which I think all of us have. I mean, we are the CVSO system, we're the front line, we're the advocates for veterans. So we wear that hat, and I think our commissioners would tell you that's what the hat they wear first. They also wear the employment hat, but that would come second to, I think, what they feel is their commitment to these, not only veterans, but their family members, that role that we do with CVSO. So I think we come to that very much committed to that. So I also think that's a common value of all of us, that veterans are at the core of this. This is not, I think the problem has been really on the implementation. It's not the value, it's not the will, it's really the practical, how do we get this done? And that's where I think we haven't quite figured that out. So I think to emphasize the status quo is confusing. It's not helping, you know, first and foremost, it's not helping veterans. It is helping our legal system in terms of the litigation that goes on, but the bottom line, it's not accomplishing, I think, what you as a legislative body wanted, which was to help veterans, to give them the access to interviews, to give them job opportunities. So I think there are some maybe, you know, step back, look at some other states a little bit, because it does get tricky in terms of implementation. So again, I think it comes back to not that we don't have common values. I think we just haven't figured out maybe concretely what that statute might look like. So I think as a work group, if you do give us more time, I think we could come back. You know, maybe there wouldn't be full agreement. I mean, we might have other segments within our group saying we prefer this over that. But I think if we could serve you that up, a more concrete statute for you to look at, you could be involved if your staffs wanted to. You'd be welcome. But I think if we did that, do the best we can with a little more time and kind of move beyond this notion that we're on we have a different agenda, because I think we have the same agenda, whether that be Boley or AOC. ODVA. So I think if you gave us that time, I think we could come back and give you some choices, what would be the best, because other states have not figured this out. It's not easy to do on the front lines.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Andy. Questions from the committee? So, you know, my two cents on this is it's not easy, it's not simple, and not every process is the same. So we can talk about fairness, we can talk about we want fair, consistent standards, we want this, we want that, but ultimately somebody might have one single interview for a job, and it might be a fairly large job and high paying, and it could be a promotion. Others might have entry level, and they're going to treat those differently. One entry level job could have 8 different parts of a process to it. Another promotion may only have 2. So at what point do you apply the preference? You know, when you asked what is the problem and what's the issue being solved, the issue that we're trying to get at, obviously, and I think we're all in agreement, is while soldiers are serving this great nation, there are people that are going to school getting preference because they've got 2-year degrees or 4-year degrees, even though that degree may have nothing to do with the job they applied for. And in some cases, that can be where that's the minimum qualification. So trying to get a veteran who may have been working in that field for 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, or more, to be able to come in and compete, to at least be accepted as a potential applicant, was real important. I agree it's not great for veterans. This is disappointing to me that we're not there yet. It's probably disappointing for veterans, too. They get their hopes up on a job opportunity. They're going to go through the process. They're going to get preference for their service, provided they give the, you know, DD-214. In some cases, veterans aren't even giving that information because they feel like it's hurting them on their job because of the fear of PTSD that they may bring to the job, because of their service and maybe what we lock into the service of the past. So some veterans aren't even telling you they're veterans, and that's a sad day, too. I agree we got to work through it. I agree we're better together than we are if this entity figures it out. But I believe this entity, again, I'm not going to be here, but I believe they've got a plan moving forward if we can't get this together. So I think my urgency is on you to continue these groups. You've had 4 meetings by testimony. I would have hoped that was enough, but obviously it's not. It's not an easy issue. I wish it was. I applaud that you're coming to the table to be a part of it. You need to be a part of it, and I'm hoping that we can get there, because this is what's best for Oregon, and there is an issue and a problem that we're trying to solve, and I think that everybody collectively is in agreement. There is an issue of dismissing somebody based on the fact that they didn't bring that qualification, despite the fact they were serving in that capacity. There is a correlation to that if you give them a chance to explain that. How you go from there, I really don't know. That's going to be, I guess, my two cents. I'll let anybody follow that up if you'd like. But if you would not like to touch this, I get it can be volatile. I get it can be polarizing. But again, a day to talk about Oregon's veterans is a good day in Oregon. This situation, when I came to the legislature in 2009, veterans were at the top of a lot of conversations, and they're easy issues to solve. This is a tough one. So I applaud you for taking it on. But at the end of the day, I can tell you the window of opportunity to support Oregon's veterans is closing. Admit it or not, they are becoming more and more distant from the average person in our society. And because of that, we don't have a lot of opportunities to continue to push the issues forward. Once that window closes, it will take another full-scale war for us to once again realize the value of service of our veterans. So with that being said, I applaud you again for taking this issue on. I want to continue to push you. I know that the labor commissioner, he has pretty much outlined the intent that he feels is strong in the legislature. He is moving forward on that. Everybody's got to get together. If it gets solved with animosity, it's not going to be good for the veterans. I can assure you that. Please solve the issue. Find a way to get to the table. Get it done, and we'll move forward, hopefully, in a way that best serves Oregon's veterans. Thank you for your time again today, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much. With that, Rick, and thank you for stepping up today and being a part of it. We've just got a few minutes left, and I guess I would put out to the committee, as I've said several times, and I say it to remind myself, which is unfortunate, that I won't be here to work with you again, but at least for now. But I do know that some of you may have some possible committee bills, some agenda items that you'd like to maybe discuss or at least put out there briefly while we have just a few moments left. If there's anything that anybody would like to step forward and say, yeah, I would like to carry this on. I've also told the Speaker's office that I want to make sure this committee doesn't fall asleep at the wheel because of the chair. They've elected to keep me as chair through the remainder of the year. But I want to make sure that we are wide awake at the wheel so that we can push forward whatever committee bills we want to sponsor. So, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, let me get this straight. You're going to be here in December then?
I've not been told I'm not allowed to be here in December, so I would imagine I'm going to be, yes.
Oh, okay.
I think I served the seat until...
Yeah. Okay, so you planned, and we could, at that point, then introduce a committee bill.
Is that correct, Rick?
Yeah. December will be the time that... committees will be introducing legislation for the 2015 session.
And then do we have to have it drafted by the 22nd?
I don't think so.
No. Okay. You have to have the bill, or at least the LC member, in place by the December meeting.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
To get the request in time to get it back by the 5th, you do have to get it in by Monday.
What's the date of the December meeting?
Oh, you got to catch me there. I'd have to look. It's
okay.
We'll have your L.A. get a hold of you. Perfect. Representative Parrish.
I think the only thing I have heard of as possible committee bill is funding for the Historical Museum, which, by the way, they raised $1.2 million two nights ago for the museum, which was a really big deal to move that forward some further. Sure. But that's the only one anybody's ever brought to me is saying, you know, this is possibly a committee bill. So.
Sorry.
And we'll be also coordinating with the Senate. I know that Chair Boquist is working on some issues, too. The Senate Vets Committee is working on a couple of issues. So we'll make sure that we have that kind of teed up, too. But, I fully intend to be here December.
Okay.
And that'll be, yes.
Well, I'm going to have one and would like it to be a committee bill. And I wanted to talk to you about it today. But maybe I'll just have to catch you later. But maybe does this last one we just heard about, I can't remember the number, I wrote it down, but that any changes to that, would that need to be in place for a committee bill?
I think there are some discussions in the building now with agencies and with legislators. I think that one's going to be getting some attention. I think we heard about we obviously heard the women's health issues with veterans.
Yeah.
I think obviously near and dear to your heart is this resilience plan.
Yep.
And what that's going to do and how do we continue to move these forward. And I think past the 6 years, we've had a lot of discussions in this room. And because we've had those discussions, they've been at the forefront, and we find compelling arguments to support them. we fail to understand they may not have gotten the traction necessary to get through the process all the way through, whether they make it out of one chamber, not the other, or whatnot. So I would just, you know, I guess I would say take a look back at the things that we've tried to get done that maybe we weren't successful on, and at least the committee can maybe make another push on those things they find interesting and worthwhile. So I do thank you all for your time today. 3 hours is a very long time. I appreciate your patience, but a lot of issues and a lot of need out there in this great state. So with that, Rick, thanks very much to you and your staff. And Ms. Ross, who's out there, thanks. So we will close the informational hearing of the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Thank you.
Good job, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for hanging in there. Yeah. I appreciate you.
Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for hanging in there. Yeah. I appreciate you.
Good job,